Good morning, and welcome to the March 30th, 2020 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. I'd like to thank everyone for calling in this morning. In the spirit of social distancing due to the COVID-19 virus, today's meeting will be conducted by telephone. Members of the public that may be on the phones are encouraged to make comment and ask questions. If you wish to speak, though, we ask that you speak, state your name and address for the record. Limit your comments to 3 minutes. Now, I will be opening up the phone lines later in this session for public comments. Morning's meeting is a study session followed by a business session this afternoon that starts at 1 o'clock. Today, we have all five commissioners on the phone, General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Wahlquist, and Rebecca Garfin, Clerk of the Board, are in the boardroom. If you would please at this time join me in a Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the Republic, one nation, under God, indivisible, with justice for all.
That's fun.
So we have in front of us, commissioners, a consent agenda. Any item is subject to transfer from the regular to consent. Is there any such request amongst commissioners? Hearing none, we will move on. Steve, would you like to present the meeting?
Yeah, we'll go to agenda item 3. This is the Peshastin Pinnacles Outreach. Steve Wickel is here. This is a project we've been working on for I believe more than 5 years, and it's about to come to culmination, and we've been also engaging the Colville Tribe, and we have Colville Tribal representatives on the phone here today. We're going to give them a chance to speak after Steve's presentation. So, Steve, turning it over to you.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Steve Wickel, the Transmission Engineering Manager. I'm here to talk about some work we have in Peshastin Pinnacles State Park. As Steve said, we've actually been working on this since about 2014. And as a reminder to the board, there is no action required. This is presentation informational only. So Peshastin Pinnacles is a 34-acre park popular with hikers and climbers. The park is named for its pinnacles or unique sandstone formations. The rock formations are thought to be about 46 million years old. And this is a registered traditional cultural property. There are different animals depicted in the rock. The rock features such as coyote and salmon that are associated with Indian legend. So why are we here? The North American Reliability Corporation in 2010 issued a recommendation to industry for all utilities to basically verify the actual field conditions, the actual construction of transmission lines compared to their design basis to make sure that everything was actually constructed as designed. In 2011 through 2013, Chelan PUD evaluated all of our transmission lines, and the last remaining mitigations on networked transmission are here in Pinnacle State Park. We need to replace the structures in the park due to some inadequate clearance concerns. So first off, we did an alternatives analysis. We first evaluated alternatives to replace the structures in their current alignment. This is in the yellow there in the center of the page. We actually brought in a firm from Seattle to perform vibration testing to see the extent of any vibration any construction activities would have on the rock formations. Concurrently with that, we had extensive outreach with affected stakeholders, including the Colville Tribe. And essentially, we concluded that rerouting around the park is the preferred option. There were a couple other options in red there. We looked at going around the park entirely down to the county road, and in blue is rerouting just around the state park property between the orchard and the state park. The basis for our decision to reroute was largely due to the risk of damage to the rock formations. This would have big impacts to key stakeholders should damage occur. Of course, the Colville Confederated Tribes, the state parks themselves, and the public who use the park. A district core value is stewardship to protect and enhance natural resources affected by district activities. Rerouting around the state park also allows for better access to the transmission structures in the future. Potential litigation costs was included in our analysis, and we did perform a cost-effective effectiveness analysis comparing the options and risks, and through that analysis, it was determined that reroute was the most cost-effective and preferred solution. So in rerouting the line, we worked with landowners and Washington State Parks to obtain easements. We obtained a construction permit from Washington State Parks. There are two construction windows. I want to remind everybody or point out that the park will be closed for the entire duration of the construction. So even in between the two windows, the park will be closed. Construction window number one is May 1st through July 31st, and construction window number two is October 1st to November 30. There are two main reasons for having two construction windows. The first is to not impact the orchards in the surrounding area, and the second is to not have construction during high fire season. While we do have construction windows valid for both 2020 and 2021, we do hope to complete this work in 2020, and the project cost is estimated at $2.4 million. And lastly, the district was recognized and awarded the 2019 American Cultural Resources Association Industry Award. This award recognizes outstanding commitment to protecting cultural resources. The award honors industry members that consistently demonstrate exemplary coordination with Native American tribes and a strong commitment to supporting scientific research, public outreach, and education. At this time, I'd like to open it up for any comments or questions.
Commissioner Smith, I just wanted to make a comment that I was made aware of this very early on, living here in Cashmere, by the one of the property owners involved, and I take it as a great success on the part of our organization that I haven't heard any gripes. I mean, I think you've dealt with the property owners locally very well, because they understand why you're doing it, and I want to say job well done in dealing with the property owners affected.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Guy Moore from the Colville Confederated Tribes, and I did not know if there was going to be an actual presentation of the award today during this call or not.
Guy, we actually are not doing the presentation today just because the board was made aware of it at a previous board meeting. So Steve did cover it, just to say that there was a relationship between the ACRA award and this project.
I would like to make a comment about the project, if I could.
By all means, go ahead.
So we have been working with Chelan County PUD since the late 90s on several relicensing projects, and have developed a very close and good working relationship with them. And for most of those years, we have been working with the environmental coordinator and cultural resource administrator, Jennifer Burns, and she was the first to bring us on board in this discussion about Peshastin Pinnacles. And as already stated, this is a very significant site, a legendary place for the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation, and we really appreciated all the efforts that Jennifer made on our behalf to work with the PUD to look for an option that wouldn't potentially damage those rock pinnacles, which are really quite fragile, because there has been previous events in the park that has caused some damage to some of the images that we are concerned with. And Jennifer was quick to point out that she could only do her job with the help of engineers and with the guidance provided by management. So she was pretty modest when it came to taking any acceptance of the praise for that. But the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation greatly appreciate the effort that was made. I think it is close to precedent setting when it comes to transmission lines. And thank you all very much. the individuals and the PUD at large for your reference.
Thank you, Guy.
Thank you, Guy. Appreciate those comments.
President Arsenault?
Yes, Commissioner Bolt.
Yes, just wanted to say, you know, to the Colville members on the phone and to my fellow commissioners and to the staff that from the beginning, this has been a very interesting and a very important project, one that I think there's a lot of pride in from all directions, and I think it's exemplary in terms of how organizations who have vested interests can work together, you know, for an excellent outcome between the landowners, the tribal interests, the power supply interests, et cetera, have all been represented well, fairly, and a good project. And it's one with pride. I think we can all look at and say, a job well done. And thank you very much to everyone and their efforts.
Well said, Commissioner Bolts. Thank you. Well, if there are no further comments, Steve, would you like to move on to the next topic?
Yeah, I think it would be time to do so. We want to say thanks to the Colville Tribal representatives who joined us. I know they were planning to, as I understood it, at least just to be here for this particular item. So we appreciate their participation. And we will move on to our next agenda item. So that next agenda item is the low-income program assessment. Josh Mitchell is here to present this. For the board, I just would like for you to know this is primarily intended just to give you some background information as we move towards rethinking our programs in the low-income arena. And so there's some good data here that will help us to better understand the customer owner interest that we serve. Josh, are you ready?
Yep, I am. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So I'm presenting from home, and I'm going to have to just tell you guys to flip to each slide. So if I forget to do that, just remind me. My name is Josh Mitchell, the District Residential Energy Advisor, and I'm here presenting the low-income needs assessment that was completed this past winter. So just as a quick reminder, there's no action requested from the board, but rather I'm just here to share some great information that came from this assessment. There's some great news that came out of this. We've been working with the Department of Commerce, and they are framing Chelan PUD's approach as the gold standard for other utilities to attain the state's new legislative requirements. I think this is really exciting. This assessment was done by Hassan Shaban and his partner Lacey Stockton, and they have a company called Empower DataWorks. They're a local consulting firm. They've done similar types of assessments in the Southeast, and you may be familiar with Hassan because he was on the long-term rate design topic team. He's on the call listening today, and if you have any questions about specific to the data collection, et cetera, he will be available. So I'm going to go through and use this term energy burden a lot today. And so I just thought I'd start by defining that. Energy burden can be looked at as the percentage of overall annual money you spend on your electric bill over your annual income. So I think it's important that we had a local consultant do this research because there were previous studies that had been done that had annual cash shortage estimates of anywhere from $0. The Department of Energy couldn't put a dollar amount on it. And then there was research showing that from Colton that was showing $46 million annual shortage for our low-income customers. And so we wanted to use data that was defensible, accurate, and would show our actual shortfall for our low-income customers. So Empower DataWorks used data that came from local public sources like our county assessor, the PUD data, as well as some proprietary sources that showed some annual income. And they were able to scrub, wrangle, and layer that data in a way that allowed us to understand, interpret, and make informed decisions about our low-income energy assistance program. So next slide, please. So we're here. One of the directives from the strategic plan was to identify ways that can ensure that the new rates will not have a negative impact on our low-income customers. The plan also calls out for our customer solutions team to consider revamping programs to ensure all customers are able to fully participate in our energy efficiency program. And so as you guys were working on the strategic plan, there was the new clean energy transformation legislation coming out, or CETA, that had some new rules in regards to complying with our low-income customers. The first step was to identify what percentage of customers in our service district were considered high energy burden. And then the second goal was to identify ways to reduce the customers who were labeled in that category. So CETA has aspirational targets of reducing the energy burden by 60% in 2030 and by 90% by 2050. So the assessment reviewed, and this is the next slide, all of these programs, our low-income disabled and senior disabled programs. We had an annual spend last year of around $110,000. Our Helping Hands program was right around $45,000. And our Conservation Low-Income Weatherization program of about $150,000. So please note, this was all done before COVID.
I apologize, but I'm having a hard time figuring out which slide you were on.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This is slide 3.
Okay.
And I apologize. Please note that all of this was done before COVID, and the Helping Hands Fund has been actively distributed during this time. So I'm moving to slide 4. So what we've learned out of this, and this is really exciting news. Chelan PUD customers have one of the lowest energy burdens in the country. We do have a small segment of customers that have a higher energy burden, and now we have data to find out where they are and how we can help that segment of customers. So we're going to go into some of the insights. If you go to the next slide on what we learned. If you look at this plot graph, there's two items I want to point out. First is that the small median energy burden of Chelan County, it's actually 1.3%. That's a typo. But we, you know, so of all the annual income, only 1.3% of our customers' money is going to paying their annual electric bill. Secondly, of note, is that if you look at the rural Pacific states plot up towards the top, rural utilities tended to have slightly higher energy burdens. That's often because of lower income and larger homes than urban utilities. And so not only do we have the lowest energy burden, we also live in a rural area. Another notable highlight is because of this low energy burden, 96.5% of our customers pay their bills on time, which is much higher than the national average. If you go to the next slide, what we've learned, the common number that it looks like the state will use that is defined for high energy burden is 6%, and that's what that orange line is on this graph. So customers to the left of that orange line are not considered high energy burden. And most of our customers fall well below that line. But there's that tail on the right side of that graph, and that that represents our high energy burden customers. And that's approximately 2,100 customers in Chelan County. And so what the idea is that we can design programs that focus on those customers on the right side of the graph, as opposed to customers that may not actually have the need. If you go to the next slide. This is another really interesting slide. It shows the map of Chelan County and where the high concentration of need is. So you can see that the yellow or lighter areas are where the higher need is in Chelan County. Of note is the outside Leavenworth, so that Chumstick, Lake Wenatchee area, there's a higher percentage of those 2,100 customers that live there. And then there's some medium priority areas in Entiat, Chelan Falls, and then some pockets in Wenatchee. So now we know where they live. They often live in mobile homes, and it's a younger demographic.
Quick question.
Mm-hmm.
On the map, which I really like, mm-hmm. I'm curious, as I expanded on my iPad, the yellow, the finger that comes down the valley, where does that finger start? You've got Wenatchee identified, but I'm curious how far down the valley that comes.
It's hard for me to state that with just looking at that as well, but I think like when we were looking at the data, it looked like it was really focused in that Chumstick area and around the lake. And maybe Hassan might be able to answer that question too.
Yes, that's correct, Josh. So it's really focused around Chumstick, and these are so the borders of the areas that you see on the map, these are census block groups. So that it doesn't really mean that there are high burden customers on the border of Chelan County to the west, but it's just a representation of that census block group.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. If you go to the next slide, we use that same need map on the left, is the one from the previous slide, and then you can look at where the 2019 funding went. And there's that little blueberry in that map on the right, and that's focused in Wenatchee. And what happened last year is that we took a lot of our low-income weatherization assistance funds and put it into a small neighborhood of multifamily HUD housing in Wenatchee. Also, our programs are funneled through the Community Action Council, and that's in Wenatchee. And so it's important to find ways to distribute these funds through the areas of higher need in the county. If you go to the next slide, this is just a graph that shows, if you remember in the first beginning of this presentation, the Department of Energy couldn't really put any money into what they thought Chelan PD needed to spend. And then that Colton study showed we needed to spend about $46 million to get our low-income customers to the left side of that graph. Well, this data that was prepared by Empower Data Works shows that we need to spend annually about $660K to get every one of our customers to the left side of that graph. Now, that's not what the state is requiring us to do, but they're just saying we need to, by 2030, have aspirational targets of getting 60% of our customers to the left side of that graph. And we've already budgeted nearly half of that $660K in current programs. And so we have a robust program for both weatherization for our low-income customers. We have robust programs for our current energy assistance programs. We now have data that can help us get that money to the people that need it the most. If you go to the next slide, here's some of the things that we'd like to do with our conservation programs to make sure that we're hitting these customers. We'd like to look into a PUD-run low-income conservation program. So in addition to the Community Action Council's weatherization program, we would explore designing a program specific to our low-income customers, and that's our next step, and we would present that to the board and have it available for public comment. We also would like to build a marketing design program that funnels, starts with a light touch and low-cost programs like energy audits, education programs, and behavioral programs, and then feed those programs into our more expensive, higher-impact programs like weatherization, particularly ones that impact our hybrid customers. If you go to the next slide, one of the things that we learned and you saw on those maps is that we need to focus on outreach strategies to specifically target our underserved geographic and demographic customer segments. So looking at our Helping Hands funds and our discount programs and helping educate our partnering agencies in those areas of high need, like, for example, the Upper Valley Mend or Chelan Valley Hope, work with them, educate them on what's available to the customers that they see on a day-to-day basis, and have them work with maybe the Community Action Council so that that we get more of those funds distributed throughout the county in areas of high need. So if you go to the last slide, in summary, we're doing great. We have, like I said, the lowest energy burden in the country. There's still customers that we want to be able to help, and we have the data to help that segment of customers. And we plan to come back to report on our progress when the conservation program design is complete. So do you have any questions for myself or Hassan?
Customer or
Hello.
Go ahead, Ann.
Okay, thanks. It's kind of hard to break. Hey, I just wanted to say thank you to Josh. Great job. I really like this energy burden. That kind of gives us a new metric. Well, it's not a new metric, but the terminology is new to me, and it makes it really easy to take a look and see where we need to just kind of to recalibrate how we're doing with our low income rates. And you know, it's great because I think Josh, you brought to us new technology, probably new data collection, so that we can really zero in and figure out, where we're overspending and where we're underspending. And so, great job. I really like this, and I'm going to use that new metric, energy burden. That's really helpful. Thank you.
Thanks, Ann.
Gary, this is Steve McKenna.
Go ahead, Steve.
Josh, good hearing you on the phone, and a great presentation. I really appreciate both you, and I apologize the name of our consultant. I've lost that name. But I really appreciate the fact of, delving in, scrubbing the data, and looking at data that really targets our ability to hone in and work directly with customers with specific needs, regardless of the area that they live in, and really do some powerful work. I am really excited about this. The data does not surprise me. Having been the superintendent up here in the Leavenworth area, that data is not shocking to me, even though I kept running into people thinking this is a very high income area. There, you know, I know that the poverty level of our up here in the area hovers around 60%, same as you find in Lake Chelan, which is not unusual for tourists and service industry businesses. So, I want to commend everybody that I think this is an amazing use of data, and I'm excited to hear what's put in place, how we can help individuals improve their energy, reduce that energy burden, and hit our metric goals, try to in the future. I can't think of anything more exciting. Very good. Congratulations.
This is Steve. If I could jump in for just a second and say, under Andrew Grissel and Josh's leadership, I think Empower has done a remarkable job here, because what they've done is brought a lot of data sets that we're not accustomed to using. So this, a lot of the data underlying this to help us better understand the low-income population is not Chelan PUD data. We don't collect income data. So by reaching out to a lot of different sources, we now have a much better ability to understand the community that we're seeking to serve. So I want to give credit there for the innovative nature of what they've done here.
I'd second that. With Empower DataWorks, they're great to work with, and I think that the other utilities throughout the state will be looking at how they can use this.
Josh, this is Glad Dennis, and the question I have relates to the yellow zone. And you made the comment that people often live in mobile homes and are younger. Are these people in those mobile homes, do they own those homes themselves, or are they renters? And how does the data split out between home ownership and rental occupancy?
Do you mind if I have Hassan answer that question, Dennis?
No, that'll be fine.
Good question.
Yeah, sure. So all of this, these charts that you see in front of you, so they're available to the customer solutions team in an online dashboard where they get to slice and dice on these different dimensions. So that they can filter down to mobile homes, they can filter down to specific locations, they can filter down by whether a home was flagged as owner-occupied or renter-occupied. That specific data point we pull basically by mapping the PUD records of whose name is on the bills, and actually whose last name is on the bills, versus county data of who owns the home. And so there is a bit of variance in there. Of course, you can imagine people, maybe the wife, the bill is in the wife's name, but she doesn't have the same last name as the husband who owns the house. But in general, it gives us a general idea of what's owner-occupied and what's renter-occupied.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So how about if we take that as a follow-up action item, too, to get the specific numbers about the out of mobile homes, how many of them are owner-occupied versus renter-occupied? And provide that to the board.
Homes in general or mobile homes, whatever the case may be, because I'd be really interested in knowing who owns their home and has a higher energy burden, and who's a renter with a higher energy burden, and who should we be working with, and how should we be working with them, philosophically as well as practically.
Yeah. And of course, So Josh did a really good job of giving kind of the concise overview of everything, but all of this is in the data, and available to us, and that's really what we would do with a program design, is to start identifying specific segments of customers. We layer on, so we've already done conservation potential for these customers, so we know how much they stand to save if we go in and install, say, a ductless heat pump or put in some insulation in their attic. So you layer on who has a high energy burden with who has a high potential for conservation, and that gives you kind of the golden level of these customers would really benefit, and they're the low-hanging fruit for conservation programs.
Yeah, and thank you for that.
Gary, this is Steve again.
Yes, go ahead, Steve.
Josh, you mentioned Upper Valley Men and Chelan Hope. When do you start? So I appreciate the outreach, and I might suggest also as you do that outreach, making a contact with the schools, because, you know, as their social workers are and counselors are working with families that are struggling, they may be a resource as well. So the question is, when and how do you start making, what's your plans for making contact with organizations? Was that in the near future?
Yeah, I think the timing is great for us to be prepared for next season's heating season. We want to start working with our Community Action Council to be prepared to work with these outer line agencies that can help us determine how we can get these areas of high energy burden covered. So we do plan to start working right away with our Community Action Council and Upper Valley Mend and other agencies that that can help us.
Great.
Commissioners, we do foresee an outreach program, possibly even including public comment on the changes we'd make to the program. And what I'd suggest is that we develop that outreach plan and share it with you, maybe even by the next board meeting.
That would be great.
I think that would be helpful.
This is Hassan. I'll just add a quick comment. Unfortunately, because of the COVID situation, what I'm seeing with other utilities, both in Washington and outside Washington, is that low-income programs are starting to anticipate that the economic fallout is going to have an impact, of course, on their programs, that there's going to be a lot more need. So I think this is good, really good timing to give out that message that Chelan PUD is going to be leading the charge on this outreach with the action community action councils with different agencies, because it's definitely going to be a time of need going forward.
Thank you.
I was just going to reinforce that probably couldn't have picked a better moment to have this presentation, although candidly it wasn't like we've been sitting on it. It just happened to be ready at this moment. But it's going to be very useful to us as we go through the next few months.
This is well done. Appreciate it very much.
There's a lot in there, and I'm sure you'll be hearing from us again, and I appreciate your guys' time.
Thanks, Josh.
All right, commissioners, if we're ready to turn to the next item, that would be agenda item 5, the coronavirus update. We have this structured so each of the managing directors will be bringing forward their thoughts, and I was going to do something introductory, but I actually don't have it in front of me at the moment. So I'm going to have John go ahead and start, and I'll do what I was going to do at the beginning at the end. John, you ready to go?
Sure am. Thank you, Steve. Everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Well, I'm going to go over a report. This is coming out of Customer Utilities, and essentially I'm going to go go through like six areas, and I've got a little bit more detail on some of the customer impacts we're seeing as well. So wanted to start off with the first area, and that is the strategy for our emergency workers. And essentially, you know, we have about 70 employees who kind of qualify under that. Think of substation wiremen, linemen, the water, wastewater operators. Those are folks that we need to be ready to go at a moment's notice for a number of issues. So essentially, we've looked at that group of employees, and we put them on a non-standard shift. So essentially, they're ready to be called out. They're on standby. They are able to do some routine work, provided we can maintain proper social distance. But essentially, our approach has been to focus on keeping the crews consistent and sequestered at home but ready to respond. The following are just highlighted critical and limited routine operations that we're doing. You know, we're a 24/7 operation, so certainly we have emergency call-outs. Several of those happened over the weekend. We do have critical system inspections, substations, pump stations, treatment plant operations. That's just equipment and facilities that we need to get eyes on and do some critical functions. Last week, we had a pole fire in a transmission structure up in the Sage Hills area. So that was, again, another opportunity where we went out and we addressed it and made that repaired and made safe. At the same time, we also continue to do utility locates, reconnection of services, and inspections, again, where appropriate social distancing is maintained. That effort to maintain the 6-foot distancing is a top priority for our workers, but we just recognize there are exceptions to that just based on the nature of the work, but we'll continue to evolve that. Strategies for non-emergency workers. Most of our workers are working remotely who fall into that. We do have folks dropping into the office to maybe they have to pick up a file. They may have a large job they need to do. But again, they're being very mindful of social distancing and maintaining that that space. We are utilizing Skype for Business, the conference bridges such as today. Phone calls have been forwarded. The Citrix system access is really critical for our folks as well. We are doing continued limited meter reading activities, essentially, again, where we can maintain that social distance. We do have the capability to do quite a bit of AMR or automated meter reading where it's a drive-by type approach. Our water system is 100% AMR, and our residential electric is about half. So when you look at the employees within customer utilities, we have about 58% that are on that non-standard shift. We have about 38% of our employees, 47 of them, who are working remotely. And then we have very limited folks working in the office. We have 5. So, and those folks are certainly spread out, paying attention to the pandemic best practices as well as social distancing. Some of the challenge we're seeing over the past couple of weeks, certainly system speed and access for the home workers is not ideal. But we continue to work through it, and I think it gets a little better every day. We're working through non-standard communication channels. It's not always easy given, you know, kind of our culture and how we've operated, but again, we're making it work. The contracted meter reading service that we relied on, they have curtailed their operations. So again, that's been a challenge to kind of work through our meter reading cycles and setting up bill estimations and meter reading estimations when needed. A sense of the backlog that's being created, our customer work, new services, installing water chambers, line extensions, primarily on the construction side, you know, that has stopped with the governor's order last week where he clarified what was an essential business activity. I think it was Wednesday, all the commercial and residential construction was halted. We do have customer service engineering operations continuing, so customers are making application where they can, but we're also seeing projects being put on pause or canceled just given the uncertainty. We anticipate that will create a bit of a bow wave once this thing settles out and people get back to projects.
We certainly had a lot on our plate for planned system improvement and growth projects, so those are certainly on hold, as well as priority operations and maintenance projects, such as the wire down strategic plan we put in place this year. Vegetation and forestry management, that's slowed down a bit. Again, we rely on contractors to a large degree to exercise that program. We're seeing slowdown in some key substation delivery components with the number of projects we have going on. Some planned substation maintenance has stopped. We have a number of planned retirements and backfills that, again, those have slowed down. Numerous fiber and third-party pole attachment requests, what it takes to do those, that is being backlogged. And customer service and billing accommodation response. So some of the challenges we foresee over the next 3 weeks, the list I just went through, I imagine that will continue to evolve. But as we start to move towards, hopefully, some semblance of what would be normal operations, I think a key challenge for us will be to balance out the critical key system work as well as the backlog and customer connections. We see those as being very high on our priority list and to balance those out. We anticipate more ramp up in customer calls, billing issues, and certainly when we start sending out estimated reads, that may have an impact on the call center. We need to really, you know, we're fairly fresh with the new C2M billing system and really watching how this kind of changed work environment impacts that system. We will be challenging it with more estimations. We're doing things not standard, so just watching that and ensuring we can maintain the stability of that system. So far, we've been fortunate. Illness has been minimal within customer utilities. However, if that changes, it certainly could impact our service levels. And we see potential challenges or changes in customer expectations associated with new construction, altered service, billing, and payment options. So I kind of went through the entire customer utilities just impact. Now I wanted to speak just a little more closely to customer relations, customer service. Hats off to that group. They're working remotely. We're seeing about 2,000 phone calls over the past 2 weeks. That's up about 25% over normal from, say, last year. A lot of it has to do just with the lobbies being closed. We are working with folks making payment arrangements, noting customer accounts, what their status is, if they have lost a job or if they're in a financial difficulty. As of Friday, we've logged about 50 of those concerns. We do have a couple of folks that come into the office essentially to process checks and payments that we receive. But again, they're pretty spread out and following the social distancing guidelines. You know, customer issues are really minimal at this point. I would say there's a lot of patience. People are just understanding this is a unique time. Interesting enough, we have seen more donations in Helping Hand. I mean, just that it's more anecdotal, but people are noticing maybe one-time contributions we're seeing. The Helping Hand, just some quick facts on that. We've requested to work with Community Action about $7,600, again, aimed at kind of the one-time help for folks who are in a financial difficulty. That certainly is a much more larger amount than we typically see. That translated to about 41 customers.
John, can you say that dollar amount again, please? I couldn't hear you.
Sure, it was $7,600.
Thank you.
We've also we've stopped charging any late payment charges, as well as doing any disconnections for non-payment. And when we look back over, again, these past 2 weeks, that equated to about 110 residential accounts and 25 commercial accounts that typically would have been up for a disconnection for non-payment. But, again, we're not doing that. We're opting to work with customers to work through this. That also brings up another point. Last week, because of the stoppage in late payment charges, that rolls through our fees and charges that's been delegated to the general manager. we gave Steve Wright a memo about what we've done, where we've essentially stopped it on March 16th, and we're recommending to keep it stopped through April 27th. However, we will continue to evaluate and monitor it. But that's an action that Steve Wright approves, and it's just an update to the board so you're aware that we've formally made that taken that action. So I'll stop there, see if there's any other questions.
Commissioners, any questions? John, I have one. If my fellow commissioners are silent at this moment. And of the 100 or so residences that you've made notes on where you would normally be up for disconnect, have you mapped them out? Do you have any idea geographically where in the county is there a pocket? Do they complement the data and the report that we heard earlier? Are they up in the Lake Wenatchee, Chumstick area?
Yeah, Gary, I'd have to look into that. I can do some research into it. I don't have that at my fingertips right now, but you know, it's probably just a listing we could scan through and see if there's any trends or patterns there. So I'll take that as an action item.
If there are no more questions at this time, and we could also take questions at the end, I would suggest we move to Kirk Hudson next.
Good morning, Commissioners. This is Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. Can everybody hear me okay? Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Wanted to start by sharing our strategy for emergency employees. Before I do that, we're certainly accustomed to responding to emergencies, but this is quite different than ones we have responded to in the past, and that being advised that our employees, to the extent practical, stay home, and if they do need to work, to stay away from each other. So this is presenting some unique challenges for us. One of the things we did in our preparedness plan was we identified those essential functions that we have to maintain operations under. When everything is happening around us and things are coming to a halt, there's things that we still have to provide 24/7. And I'll just briefly run through the list of those 10 essential functions that we provide and will continue to do so. First one is maintaining dam safety and safely passing water through the dams. Generating electricity with available units for our community and power purchasers. Sustaining fish passage through adult and juvenile systems. Troubleshooting and responding to problems with communications and critical systems. Maintaining compliance with regulatory requirements. Real-time transmission operations support. This includes the next day transmission studies as well as short-range studies that have to occur daily. Control system updates and monitoring, the balancing authority responsibilities, balancing generation and load and meeting power purchaser requests, outage coordination with regional reliability coordinator, and dispatching crews as necessary. So those are all things that we will continue to do 24/7, regardless of the things that happen around us. Those are the essential functions we are providing. We've implemented three strategies for our emergency workers. One, we've asked those that are able to work remotely to do so. We've also temporarily curtailed project work in the powerhouses and switchyards for 2 weeks in order to minimize exposure to those employees that provide those functions I listed. And we are minimizing exposure to those that are here providing those essential functions by honoring the 6-foot distancing where we can, and then staggering hours as much as possible to try and limit how many people are around any given time. For non-emergency personnel, we have three strategies as well. First one is, again, if they're able to work remotely, we've asked them to do so. If they can't work remotely but don't work in the powerhouses and switchyards, that they are able to work but certainly have to follow the strict 6-foot distancing requirements. And if they can't work remotely but normally work in the powerhouse and switchyards, we've asked them to stay home, similar to the group that John mentioned, and remain available to be called in to support as needed. Just to give you a feel for the number of employees, we've got 269 employees in generation and transmission. 35% of those are designated as emergency personnel who are currently working shifts to provide those essential services. And then we have an additional 25% who are supporting and working remotely. The number of challenges wanted to work through, one of them being trying to determine what work in the powerhouses and switchyards will need to get done after the 2 weeks. And just for a frame of reference, we are now 1 week into that 2-week period, so we're just beginning our second week. We'll also have a number of contracts that we'll have to work through, which is in the process of doing, where we have contractors in place doing a lot of the work for us in those areas. And then meeting reliability standard requirements. Much of that work is handled on-site. Almost all of it usually is. And so now we're trying to adapt to making sure we stay in compliance while a large number of our workforce is working remotely. Staying connected with a lot of employees in different locations has been a challenge, but so far we've been doing pretty well there, I would say. And then staying connected with our peer utilities. And I think one of the biggest challenges there is the number of phone calls with our brethren utilities and each telling us what they're doing, and then having the discernment to figure out what makes sense here. There's some unique challenges there. The backlog that we've already identified, I can say Powerhouse 1 modernization efforts have been delayed at least 2 weeks. We're working through that. The trunnion bushing replacement project at Rocky Reach, C2 through 7, is also delayed at least 2 weeks. Chelan Powerhouse unit overhaul work that was scheduled here in the next few weeks is likely going to be delayed until probably next year, mainly because we have constraints when we can take those units out up at Chelan. We're also likely deferring unit overhaul work at Powerhouse 2 at Rock Island that's scheduled in April. We've canceled a number of on- and off-site training sessions, and we postponed a number of public outreach efforts associated with fire and weather hardening of the transmission system up Plain Lake, Wenatchee, Leavenworth areas, the Stehekin outreach effort, Discovery Center education efforts, and visits and tours to the dams. Over the next 3 weeks, many of those things I listed will likely continue to be challenges. A couple of projects, one you heard about this morning, the Pinnacles, the other one right nearby, Goodwin Bridge replacement. We've got plans with contractors to support both of those projects, and it's just anybody's guess right now as to what the construction and contractor guidance is going to look like in the next several weeks. And so we're still planning to go forward with those, but recognizing that things are changing rapidly too, and that might be a challenge for us. And then determining when to begin postpone work. That's, we feel like we can maintain this for another week or two, but then we're going to have to do some things that we put on hold, especially out at the hydros. And then trying to stay focused on a long-term strategy in the middle of a crisis has certainly been a challenge when new information is forthcoming each and every hour, and trying to adapt, it's been pretty hard for us to look way out there in the future while in the middle of that. item of note would be Powerhouse 2 negotiations is continuing on schedule. We actually began negotiations using new video conferencing technology, so that is moving ahead. And then as I conclude, I just wanted to mention that multiple employees certainly passed along their sincere appreciation for how the PUD is treating them at this time, and they are eager and ready to figure out all kinds of creative ways to meet our customer needs in this challenging environment. So with that, I'll ask if there's any questions.
Commissioners, any questions? Kirk, I happen to have one, and that is with the two-week deferral of work. Is that impacting any of the agreements that we have with Andres or others with respect to timelines?
It is certainly impacting the contract with Andres that we're in the process of working through on the two-week impact. We've specifically with Andres, we've asked them to try to continue as much as they can of the work outside the powerhouse, but to refrain from any of the work inside the powerhouse for those 2 weeks. So that's a really good example of one of the things that we have to work through, a field work order, change order to address that situation.
Kirk, you mentioned the 2 weeks, recognizing new guidelines for social distancing. At least the recommendation from the president. Do you see an impact happening to us that way?
I tell you, I missed part of that, Randy. Can you would you mind repeating that?
Well, the presidential guidelines that came out yesterday extend the social distancing component of recommendations to the end of April now, and I'm assuming that we're probably going to get further extension. Are we going to get further delays probably as this crisis continues to go forward?
Well, we certainly could. Right now we're trying to figure out what we can do and whether there's things we can do with if the social distancing cannot be strictly adhered to. Are there things we can do with personal protective equipment and things like that to try and continue the work forward? But I think you're right, Commissioner Smith, in terms of we're probably going to be operating with some impacts for a while, and it's anybody's guess right now how long that would be. And so the name of the game for us is how do we get creative and how do we continue to get as much work as we can done safely without mitigating or without exposing our emergency personnel to risks that wouldn't be appropriate.
Maybe if I'll add to that, just to speak broadly from a district perspective, about 10 days ago, we decided that we needed to do something to protect field personnel. And so we put a rather, I'd say, rather blunt instrument in effect. And spent a good portion of last week trying to figure out how to implement that. One of our goals for this week is to begin to think through, you know, as Kirk said, we're 1 week into a two-week period here, so we really need to think through what's the next step, how do we better refine the approach that we've taken to try to find ways to be able to get work done but keep employees safe. So more to come on that, and it'll apply to all the field operations folks. If there are no other questions at this time, I'd suggest that Mike Coleman go next.
Okay. Good morning, Commissioners. Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom. I'm going to start with the strategy that we put in place for the emergency workers. We went to a non-standard shift using a staggered crew utilization plan. One of three designated combined crews composed of linemen and communications specialists works on any given day, Monday through Friday, Therefore, two of the crews are off schedule on any given day, and they stay sheltered to the extent possible, remaining available for major outages or emergencies. We, like the other operating units, are practicing all the social distancing and pandemic best practices to the extent possible. Our strategy for non-emergency workers, in our case, the staff, the network admins, and telecom engineers, are working remotely. On the few occasions they must come to the office, they're following all of the best practices. Approximately 50% of the employees are working remotely. The other 50% are emergency workers who must be on site and in the field to perform work. The challenges that we're seeing, first and foremost, is we did experience some latency and congestion coming out of Leavenworth, Cashmere, ENEAT, Chelan, and Manson on March 21st through 23rd. We immediately rerouted and performed some path management, which corrected all of those issues. This was known as a side effect of a failover condition in the NT cards. We've been able to clear up all of the congestion related to that. I included a graph in the package right behind Josh Mitchell's presentation, which shows the bandwidth in the different nodes. I'll admit up front, it's a very, very busy graph. However, Saddle Rock is the busiest node in the network and is exceeding the 90% OLT link utilization during peak hours. On the graph, that's kind of the gray-green line, which is the highest of all of the lines. That does concern us. It is operating up at the same levels that we saw briefly during the holiday season at the end of the year, 2019. So we're moving to take action, and the actions are underway to significantly offload some bandwidth onto new links as a precautionary action. The initial steps were taken last night in a maintenance window. Final steps will be taken tonight, actually Tuesday morning, starting at 1 minute after midnight in another maintenance window. This will reroute 10 gigabits per second off of the links to the core and will add greater flexibility to both the Saddle Rock node and the core. This rerouting is consistent and in line with our Layer 2 upgrade, which is planned for late in the year. Our other big challenge is the compounding effect related to social distancing and working remotely. Projects and work activities continue, but they're moving at a slower pace, set primarily by our ability to get work accomplished under the constraints of our telecommuting technologies and inefficiencies created by working apart. Otherwise, we continue to move forward. The sense of the backlog that's being created, there are two major areas of concern. Primarily, it's a result of only working one-third of the emergency workers every day. But we also have this expectation that nothing can be eliminated or delayed forever, and all work remains necessary. Our normal and routine activities continue. We are also seeing that customer expectations remain high. Our trouble tickets are growing faster than we can resolve. However, we have prioritized outages and set degraded services at a lower priority. If somebody's out of service, we are getting it repaired. If somebody has maybe a pixelization on one of their video channels, then we set that at a much lower priority. Our non-emergency maintenance work is accumulating. And with the frequent handoffs between work groups every day is creating inefficiencies and requires some extended time frames. Our projects, both capital and O&M, continue to meet operational needs. We're just seeing slower progress with lesser available resources to perform the work. We do foresee having to spend some money taking some mitigation actions, particularly with the bandwidth in the network. Our PPV construction has stopped. We are still performing some connections, both in PPV and out. Any connection that does not require pole attachment or the involvement of the electrical crews or major construction, of course, we're continuing to try to work. The challenges in the next 3 weeks are going to be more of the same, but we are expecting no worse. We foresee that customers may begin to complain because of our delayed response times. We also are losing one of our senior telecom engineers, and that departure will have a compounding effect on maintaining and managing fiber needs for the group. It's shifting the workload from two engineers to one while we're operating under the COVID-19 restrictions. The anticipated uptake in work activity during the recovery period is also going to be impacted heavily by losing this engineer. The other challenge that we see is that one of our primary contractors, Paramount Construction, has self-elected to not work in Chelan County during the COVID-19 situation. So, pretty similar to the other operating units, and I'll stop there and ask if there are questions.
Commissioners, any questions for Mike?
Mike, this is Randy. Is that contractor that is self-elected, are they from the other side of the mountain?
Commissioner Smith, I believe they're from the southern part of the state, but they have operations across the state.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else?
Okay, like I said, we can also take questions at the end if there are any. Next up will be Justin Erickson.
Good morning, Commissioners. Justin Erickson, Managing Director of District Services. District Services does not have emergency workers in the same context as the operating units. However, of course, we provide essential support to those emergency workers and activities and projects, and so we either continue to do that for efforts that are ongoing or we are on standby in some areas. Of course, this time of year, we are approaching our spill season, so in that context, some of our fish and wildlife staff are up there close to emergency workers, and they conduct daily fish sampling at both Rocky Reach and Rock Island projects from April 1st through August 31st, and they are ready to go, and their daily work will continue, of course, beginning this week, with modifications in place to ensure social distancing and to limit exposure risk. For our non-emergency workers, they are working remotely or in accordance with all guidance, as others have described. We estimate within District Services that approximately 75% of employees are working remotely and are able to do so effectively. The other 25% or so must be on site and or in the field to perform their essential work. So that includes individuals that work in areas such as parks, fleet, fish and wildlife, facilities and lands, and materials and warehouse. With regard to challenges within the PCS and project management group, we're having to figure out how to do public bid openings and meet the statutory requirements. We've got a process in place with this Friday being our first opening. Actually, looking at implementing an online streaming process where we can provide those bid openings in a very public manner that any bidders or general public could witness that activity be in conformance with statute. We are also, many of our projects, of course, are complex and benefit from pre-bid meetings. And so we have done some of those remotely, and we'll probably continue to do that more and be better at it as we continue, assuming these measures continue. We are also seeing some diminished interest from bidders, requests for time extensions, etc. And so certainly we understand that this is an unstable bidding climate, at least for some projects. And so we know that could come with it, financial risks with fewer bidders and maybe price differentials, as well as quality and time risks. So we continue to evaluate that. At this stage, don't have a lot of quantification of that, but it is certainly an identified risk and challenge that we're monitoring. Parks facilities continue to also be a challenging management issue. And what we're seeing, of course, with the governor's order is a strong desire from the public to be outside, because that is one way that you can effectively get some exercise and implement social distancing. We know that outdoor exercise is an essential activity under the governor's order. And so what that means for us is that our parks facilities are still seeing very high usage, higher than normal, even with and less dependent upon the weather. Where normally this time of year you might have more weather impacts, it seems to be, regardless of the weather, we're seeing a fair amount of high usage. We, of course, do have some COVID-related park closures or seasonal closures that we have simply extended. And then other operational challenges, such as restrooms and discouragement of group gatherings. We've implemented a lot of signage and continue to make a lot of contacts with folks that had events scheduled and had activities scheduled. But we are seeing in the last few days good compliance with the social distancing and group gathering limitations that have been put in place by the governor a week ago or so. In terms of the sense of backlog being created, right now the backlog does not appear to be extensive in most divisions, with normal and routine activities continuing in large part. However, as Kirk mentioned, there are some projects, capital and O&M projects that are slow or delayed. So we continue to monitor that. And then, of course, our purchase and contracting department was already exceptionally busy with an aggressive capital and O&M projections this year. And so with some work pausing, as things do eventually get back to more normal conditions, do expect them to be further inundated. And so we're going to have to be probably kind of ruthless in how we prioritize and just determine what work becomes a priority once the gates open up again. So challenges in the next 3 weeks, as Mike mentioned, kind of more of the same of what I've already mentioned. So that's true with parks. As the weather continues to warm and high usage continues, we're going to monitor public expectations and our response to that. We have the potential for additional delays with projects, as noted. And I wanted to end on a good note, so we are able to effectively continue a lot of the work that we're doing, really all of the work that we're doing related to our service center project. So we're thankful that so many of our consultants that we've got on board with that project are able to effectively work from home and work remotely. And so that project continues to be on track. That concludes my summary. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Commissioners, any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up will be Greg Carrington.
Commissioners, Greg Carrington, Managing Director of Energy Resources. And just a reminder, Energy Resources consists of energy planning and trading and our conservation team as well. Our strategy overall, we began implementing our remote working strategies as outlined in the business continuity plan. We started implementing that on March 12th. All non-emergency staff are working remotely at this point. Our entire team meets on a weekly basis to identify any issues associated with working remotely and to quickly respond to any problems that are happening. 100% of our team is working remotely, but there are a few times that we do have to go into the office. We work very closely with system ops and hydro operations, and sometimes with control system engineers, and to the extent that there is an issue associated with our independent operations, then we may need to go into the field, but it's on an on-call basis. The challenges that we're having so far are mostly related to connectivity associated with Citrix and the phone systems. IT and the tech shop have been incredible during this time frame. I talked directly with all of our workers, and they had nothing but good things to say about IT and the tech shop and the fact that they respond very quickly. So I just wanted to shout out to them. I know that they're under a lot of stress. Our entire systems are being impacted by this, but they're really doing a great job. As far as the backlog being created, even though we're able to work remotely, I do feel like the overall efficiency and effectiveness of our normal work activities is, I guess you could say, more awkward and cumbersome. We expect to become more efficient as we get used to working remotely, but our team is such that we sit near each other and we have instantaneous feedback associated with trades that we're doing or energy efficiency programs, and that level of efficiency can't be there when you're working remotely and you're trying to get a hold of people. Challenges we foresee in the next 3 weeks. First of all, we see potential decreases in the wholesale energy prices caused by a reduction in energy demand as industry and commercial activity slow down. Fortunately for the district, we've hedged the majority of 2020 and 2021 wholesale energy portfolio in advance. So as a result, we are barely sheltered from price movements over the next couple of years. There will be some impact on the unhedged energy and services. And I've provided for you two things. One in the graph that was provided is an impact on our load, and it's immediately following the graph that Mike provided to you. And that was on March 26th. It shows that there was a drop in our load during the peak of about 5 megawatts. I took a look at the load profile today, and there's a drop of about 10 megawatts as of today. So slowly over time, our load profile is changing slightly. I also noticed that our peak load has changed from 8 o'clock in the morning to 9 o'clock in the morning. It may have something to do with people working from home and waking up a little bit later than normal. And also the evening peak has shifted slightly, but it's approximately the same time period as we normally would expect. There's going to be some other challenges coming up in the next 3 weeks, mostly associated with month-end type of reporting that we do. If you've ever walked through our facilities and our office area, you'll notice that people had somewhere between 4 and 6 screens in front of them as they're doing their closeouts at the end of the month. When they're working from home, they only have, you know, 1 or 2 monitors in front of them. So being able to reconcile the accounting and the balance at the end of the month associated with environmental attributes is going to be a little more difficult than working in the office. I anticipate that some of our staff will have to go into the office during that time frame and be able to do the end of the month balancing. I don't know whether they'll be able to do that at home or not. We'll yet to be determined. As far as the market goes, I also have included a market update. And generally speaking, we're not seeing a huge change in the energy prices right now. I will be providing on a weekly basis, sending it out to Steve, but I recommend that you all get a copy of it as well. We will, on a weekly basis, provide a load profile, but we also provide you on a weekly basis the changes in prices over time. So far, the year-end prices have changed by maybe $1 to $3, but nothing significant. And I think I'll pause there and see if there are any questions.
Greg, this is Gary, and I happen to have a question with respect to what's going on with OPEC and Russia and driving down oil prices, and to the extent that that will impact, which I think is a very focused impact on our frackers in the United States, many of which are contributing to natural gas. Do you have any projections being play out in the Middle East as to what we might experience, how that's going to impact our energy prices going forward?
Yeah, we've already seen a huge drop in natural gas prices, and as you know, most of the pricing in the United States is based on natural gas. There's a one-for-one correlation associated with energy prices and the price of natural gas, which has a link. It used to be more based on fossil fuels, you know, from an oil perspective, and now it's mostly natural gas. So to the extent that there's less usage of natural gas and there's a diminishing in the price, we will be seeing that. Right now, tomorrow, Tuesday, is trading at 1661 on light hours, and it's trading on heavy hour at 1717. So there's a 50 cents differential between heavy and light load in extremely low pricing as of tomorrow. So those are the types of things that we're keeping an eye on and we'll report to you.
Thank you.
Okay, again, we can take more questions at the end if anyone has some. Next up, be Kelly Boyd.
Good morning, Commissioners. Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer, giving you the finance, risk, and IT update. So roughly 85% of finance, risk, and IT staff are working remotely. We have about 8 to 10 people who are on site at both the headquarters and the CTC building, providing emergency services like IT, help, cybersecurity, and paying the bills. For those who are on site, we are practicing the social distancing and pandemic best practices, and we've also taken the extra step to spread out in work locations to increase work distances. For some people also, they're just stopping in for, you know, quick document exchange and grabbing a prep materials. The challenges we are having is the rapid increase in the demand for remote usage. It's overwhelmed our remote environment, and it's been very challenging for IT system administrators and the help desk. We went from typically having about 60 concurrent users to as high as 334 this last week. We had about 165 Citrix licenses, which are our remote user licenses. We purchased 50 additional ones, thinking that was going to be plenty, but now we have 100 more licenses on the way. We also purchased and installed additional bandwidth licenses, deployed additional servers to handle the remote traffic, and have been doing some late-night maintenance to help stabilize the system and increase its performance. Over the last few days, the system has stabilized, and I'm knocking on wood when I say that. And we're solving isolated issues as they arise. And there's a graph in your materials. That's a really interesting one that does show kind of how it's a two-day graph where it shows how the usage peaks during the day. Video conferencing capabilities have been a challenge because they're not available through the Citrix with people working remotely. So we know this is a key need as people continue to do their work remotely, but we had to put it on hold because we were dedicating all of our available resources to the highest priority, which was keeping the overall computing and network infrastructure stable and available. So as we seek stability and realize that, we'll then focus on the video conferencing capability as resources become available. And I appreciate Greg's kind words for the IT staff. I would also like to recognize them for their efforts on keeping our system available. And then in addition to our IT challenges, as you'll hear more about it this afternoon, but the financial markets have also been disrupted and are challenging our bond financing activities. So we've adapted our plans. We're focused on preserving liquidity and flexibility, and also plan to be ready to execute when market conditions are beneficial. So again, you'll hear a little bit more about this afternoon. And then we are also striving for completion of our annual financial statement audit, because that's a precursor for our ability to do our bond financing activities. As you may be able to tell, many of our IT projects have slowed down or been put on hold as we focus on keeping the system available. And so that will be one of the things that we'll need to realign our technology roadmaps and get kind of back in sync from a district-wide perspective when resources become more available. And then same goes for our other 2020 goals, but we're continuously evaluating priorities to ensure that the highest priority projects stay on track. The challenges we see for the next 3 weeks are anticipating that keeping our IT system stable and available for all the remote users will continue to be a challenge. And the longer these conditions last, the more delay we may have in completing our 2020 goals. And then also over the long term, we do anticipate that there will be negative impacts on our 2020 financial results as a result of all of the COVID-19 impacts. But because of our strong financial health, our prudent financial policies that include strong liquidity and the low debt leverage, in addition to our hedging practices, we anticipate that we are well positioned to weather the storm. And currently, there's just too much uncertainty to predict what the financial impacts on 2020 might be. And then finally, I also want to end on a good note, and I'd like to recognize Greg Larson, who is our IT director. He's retiring tomorrow. And so we aren't able to gather and show him the appreciation we would like to, so I'd just like to officially thank him for his 23 years of dedicated service to the district and our customer owners.
Questions?
It's a heck of a time to retire when there's nobody around to say thank you.
Yeah, it's been kind of hard, because you really can't show the appreciation that you would really like to. But we're going to do something later.
Thanks, Kelly.
Hi, this is Ann Congdon. Yeah, I just want to say thank you to Greg, and he's been there as long as I've been there. Well, he's been there longer, but he's done a great job. Always been really, really nice to work with, and I appreciate his hard work and his great attitude over the years. Thanks, Greg, and the best.
Thank you, and I'll pass that on.
Good, thanks.
If there are no other questions, I would like to move to Tim Pettit.
Good morning, Commissioners. Tim Pettit, Director of Safety and Human Performance. Again, slightly different than operations, we provide an essential service mainly to our Chelan County PUD employees. And so a few of the things that we're doing to protect ourselves is we're staggering our working schedules. That helps increase our social distancing. But we still need to maintain a solid presence here at the district for employee support. Some of the ways we're doing that is our safety coordinators are participating in daily conference calls within their areas of responsibilities. That helps maintain the relationships and involvement in those specific needs. In addition, our safety coordinators are conducting their own daily team teleconference meetings to discuss multiple challenges that they may be coming up with, sharing of thoughts and plannings, et cetera. We do have a strong focus on our internal office maintenance and cleaning. We have, at this point in time, 10 employees in our Safety HPI department. And so with their varied expertise, we are all considered emergency employees. So some of the things that we're doing here, and we're fortunate to be located where we're at, our offices are substantially a good distance apart. So although we are working, many of us, during the day, all day here, we are doing a very conscious job of our social distancing and actually using our phones to communicate with each other. So our staff, we all can work remotely, and we all are doing that at times. Again, we're trying to maintain that relationship with our employees. Some of the challenges we're having that reflect on that, advancement of our quality, safety, and HPI culture is built on strong personal relationships. So that makes it very difficult to do what we do best under these conditions. But our employees continue to maintain engagement. We are experiencing a backlog of training needs and requirements for our employees. Some of those look like, you know, our first aid, CPR, flaggers, forklift training, a number of those. We are monitoring those very closely, tracking those. But those will create some real challenges as we move forward. Maintaining full compliance with some of our required training, as well as other areas where we maintain above compliance standards as a district. And fortunately, because the district has chosen to maintain above compliance standards, we do have some cushion, you might say, in some of these areas. Many of the courses that we would be performing at this time are refresher courses, again, because we maintain an above compliance record. We can get through these refresher courses without without moving out of compliance in a number of areas. So we're planning, we're tracking, we're looking at rescheduling and efficiently fulfilling the safety and compliance requirements. And that's going to be challenging with hundreds of employees, mainly because we're going to have to work hard to minimize the impact to the backlog of work that's occurring across the district. Being a lineman myself, knowing what Kirk, Mike, and John are going to be dealing with as this rolls out, their people are going to want to get back to work and accomplish a lot in a short amount of time. So there's going to be some real challenges in scheduling and creating time to provide the training that needs to be done. And to wrap this up, I think one of our primary challenges and concerns is the safety and HPI department. We're building heavily on this HPI culture, which is an extremely positive thing, and that takes a lot of personal face-to-face, eye-to-eye contact. And I think as we move back into some sense of normalcy here in the near future, hopefully, we're going to really have to focus our workforce not so much on our HPI principles, but on the concepts that we've learned along the way, which is building in defenses, paying close attention to critical steps, and really focusing on drift, because drift is easy to do when you have...
Oops. Tim, we lost you.
Lose everybody.
I'm here.
I'm here.
Kirk's still here. He's here.
Yeah, I'm here too. Randy.
Okay. Commissioner Congdon, are you still there?
Yeah. I'm here. Yep.
Okay. All right. So I think we're going to, I'm not sure why we lost Tim, but we'll move on to Lorna and hopefully we can pick Tim up back at the end here.
He can do it again because he's still talking to himself right there.
Good morning, Commissioners. This is Lorna Klemanski, Managing Director of Human Resources. Can you all hear me fine?
Yes.
Great, thank you. So about 30% of human resources employees are considered emergency workers because we figure everyone wants to get paid. All of those people that are emergency workers are critical to producing payroll. One of them is working 100% from headquarters because there is no internet service available at her home. Others are working remotely most of the time. We also have someone who comes in to do some minimal onboarding of new employees. We don't want to lose some of the great candidates we've made offers to, and so we're still bringing people on board. Otherwise, our non-emergency workers are working remotely. We do have three people who are rotating and coming in one day out of three to be on site for handling issues needing a presence or to facilitate any processes. We still have currently a lot of paper processes, which we are working on moving to electronic workflow where we can. So rough percentage on any given day is 60 to 75% are working remotely and 25 to 40% are on site. We're having some challenges, especially in the recruiting area. Pandemic has arrived just at the peak of our hiring season, and we are always challenged at this time of the year to try to provide enough recruitment support to meet everybody's demands as it is. We are worried, though, that if we fall behind or pause now, the district will be significantly impacted once we're able to get back up to full recruiting speed. And, you know, if we pause and then try to pick up later, it'll be, you know, weeks or months later when we're able to bring on the workers that are needed. So examples of ways hiring processes are being impacted is, as you can imagine, with government closures of schools, you know, we have HR people, interview panels, and candidates are unable to be available for on-site interviews or even sometimes remote interviews. We also have, we do some testing through other government agencies, and so testing of candidates is delayed. We are trying to find some workarounds, so that's taking some time to do some kind of interviewing that's not on site. Candidates are unwilling to travel, and we're restricting visits anyway for people from coming to our facilities. And then some candidates are just withdrawing because of the uncertainty about everything, including travel and relocation. But we do have to make some decisions on case-by-case basis regarding whether to move forward with certain processes or not, because we know that the candidate pools are likely to be smaller and maybe not as robust, but delay is also a concern. So currently we haven't experienced impacts due to any candidates being ill, but that could come as well. And then in labor and employee relations, we've been spending a lot of time working with the IBEW to get agreements for more flexibility to how we do our work during the pandemic, such as alternate schedules, assigning different work if necessary, exploring options to potentially sequester some employees. Also been reaching out to retirees to see if any of them would be willing to fill in if there is a drastic shortage of available emergency workers. And we are remaining available to answer questions and concerns from employees. Payroll has been impacted primarily because Congress and legislators at the state level have gotten very busy and are giving us a lot of legislation to try to parse and try to do programming changes in the system and try to make sure that we are paying according to the laws that will go into effect on Wednesday. Also, our administrative processes, as I was mentioning, they're mostly paper-based. We're still onboarding new employees because we don't want to lose them, but we have only 72 hours after hire to get I-9, that's identification documentation, gathered and reviewed, and we have to examine them in person. That's the law. So there are lots of other processes for managing employees and their data that are also manual and paper-based. And one of the things we are doing during this time is to make sure that we can put more of those processes into electronic means for both efficiency and for social distancing. So sense of backlog, I think you already got the sense that we're going to have a big backlog in recruiting. In payroll, we are legally mandated to keep that moving forward, so I don't imagine that we're going to see any backlogs there, but it does mean that our payroll manager is working longer and with even greater intensity than usual to maintain attention to accuracy and details while still getting all of the new legislative mandates implemented. In learning and development, you know, we were hoping to make a lot of strides in developing employees this year, getting them ready to face the future. And because of the challenges we're facing in recruiting, we are delayed in hiring for that position. And then administratively, we will have to catch up on providing a fuller orientation to employees who are missing it during this period. We are trying to maintain social distancing, so we're bringing people on, we're doing the absolute minimum, making sure we get their identification documents, but we're not doing the full onboarding that we do with people typically. And then over the next 3 weeks, you know, I think that during the past few weeks, the senior team and the incident command team and human resources have all devoted a lot of time and energy to working through policy issues and developing response plans and setting up programs. Those fundamentals are now beginning to take shape, and we are about as prepared, I think, for now as we can be to address the effects we're going to be feeling operationally as employees become ill and are isolated or quarantined. But in the next few weeks, that's what we're going to be struggling with. It'll be the operational impact of people actually becoming ill or needing to be isolated or quarantined. So every hour is going to bring new challenges for our supervisors, and the human resources staff will be here to help them out as best we can. And I also would like to give a shout out to our friends in IT for making it possible for most of my staff to be pretty effective working remotely. That's what I have. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Lorna. Any additional questions for Lorna?
Thank you.
With that, I understand Tim Pettit is back on the line. Tim, we lost you as you were talking about drift.
Yes, evidently. So maybe just to wrap this up, commissioners, you know, we have work as planned and work as it gets done, and in the middle of all of that is drift. And as I was mentioning, I think that's going to be one of the primary focuses for safety and HPI as the workforce does begin to get back to some sense of normalcy, is to make sure that we create an atmosphere where they can take time, focus on critical steps, have that questioning attitude to make sure we're taking the proper steps and avoid that drift as much as possible. We've done a lot of work over the last years, and so hopefully that training that was done, that knowledge that was gained, will stick with everybody, and we'll get through this in a safe manner as we get back into our work practices. So with that, is there any questions, comments?
Thanks, Tim. Commissioners, any questions for Tim? Hey, Tim, I have one question. Are you employing any technology like Zoom for continued safety meetings or any kind of training?
So added technology in that fashion, Gary, we have not. I believe one of the things that you may have noticed is for our safety meetings, we performed a video for March that covered our safety subjects, and then we're also available for any emails or conversations back on that. We will be performing the same in April. We are working on that video at this time to make sure that our employees still have access to our safety subjects for the month.
And I would just add, you heard Kelly say that one of the goals is to enhance our options available for video conferencing, thinking about Zoom and other options. Just had to first of all stabilize the system, but next up we'll be looking at are there other ways to be able to provide some of the access to some of those good tools that are out there.
Thank you.
If there are no more, I'm going to move to Eric.
Commissioners, good morning. Eric Walquist, General Counsel, Chief Compliance Officer. So the legal audit and compliance teams are actually almost entirely working remotely at this point in time. The same kudos are well-deserved to the IT support structures that we have in place because all of the team members are able to access Citrix and to get on and do the work that they need to do remotely. The only exceptions to that are when people need to come in and pick up paperwork or assignments to take home to work on remotely. There are some instances like today's board meeting, tomorrow's audit committee meeting as planned that will require members of our team to be on site in person, but we are operating in a fashion that limits that on site need as much as possible, and then with institution of appropriate social distancing when we are here. Other than that, we have Stacy Jagla and her team when audit who are required to be here for periods of time to work with various departments on warrants primarily, although over the last couple of weeks they have worked out ways to shift even more of that work to remote work that they're able to coordinate online and lessen the need for them to be here in person. So far we've been able to perform all the responsibilities that are necessary working remotely. Don't anticipate that changing during the next several weeks or however long we're forced to do that, and then I know that we're all looking forward to getting back in the office to some semblance of normalcy. I will echo Kelly's comments and say that Karen Wiggum, her last day at the district after 20 years will be tomorrow. She is retiring along with her husband, Dave, at the same time to move on to whatever the next chapter holds. We're disappointed we weren't able to celebrate her retirement before she retired, but have every intention of doing so at some point when it's safe to do so in the future. And I will let you all know when that is and where in case you are interested. That's all I have.
Thanks, Eric.
Gary, this is Ann Condon.
Go ahead.
Hey, again, I just want to thank Karen Wiggum. I'm sorry to see her go, but I'm happy for her. She'll probably be out skiing and biking, and she's been terrific. I know when Carol Wardell was there, she was Carol's right-hand gal. Her expertise in the water area is really going to be missed, but I wish her well, and I hope she'll come back and visit us sometime.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'll let her know.
If there are no other questions, I'd like to wrap up with a few thoughts just to make sure the board is aware. First of all, we are operating with an incident command structure in place, but generally incident command structure is about implementing a plan that was in place before the event occurred. This is an event that we had a plan for, but I have to say that it never anticipated something as big as what we have going on right now. So we also have the senior management team meeting daily to resolve the policy issues that arise, and they are coming up on a pretty regular basis. You can probably get a sense from this description that our district performance plan's taken some pretty heavy body blows right now, and there will be consequences. It's hard to predict the consequences because it's really difficult to tell how long this will go on. We've been trying to look at some of the modeling work that's out there about infectious disease transmission. How does it play out through time? One of the scary things is that in this circumstance, as we are frequently told, you either need a vaccine or drugs that can help cure the effects. If you don't have those, you're down to social distancing. Question will be, how long will it take to get some of those other things? The 18-month date that we hear pretty regularly is quite concerning because it's difficult to find ways to continue to operate with the full social distancing for something that would stretch for that long a period of time. So we really honestly have just focused on how do we get something in place right away to do social distancing, and we'll be increasingly turning our attention to if this goes on for a while, how will we be able to manage? I did want to let you know that we have worked through a fair amount of the, we've sent everybody home that can work remotely. And then we have worked through when work cannot be performed remotely, what's our structure for dealing with that? We are saying that if work can be performed predominantly outdoors with full social distancing, then we want it to continue. So we have some projects like that. We have also said that if the job needs to be done now or there would be an imminent failure on the system of any kind, reliable utility service, environmental health, regulatory compliance, that even if we had to violate social distancing requirements, we would do so in order to preserve those services. We've taken the remainder of jobs that are out there and just identified the ones that can the be job. Does the job need to be done now in order to minimize risk for the system? Things like payroll would be a great example of that. If we don't pay folks, then that's going to be a really big problem. And then anything that can be performed indoors with full social distancing, but it supports an essential service, doesn't need to be performed immediately, then actually, if it doesn't need to be performed immediately in order to be able to preserve the system, then we are sending those folks home. So those are the rules for today. I can't say that they'll be the rules 2 weeks from now. We continue to work through a whole set of issues on that. Final thing, I do want to make you aware that we have positioned at least to address the issue of what happens if we have an employee who is COVID-19 positive in the workforce. We've been fortunate so far to not have that. The policy that we've developed after extensive conversations with local community health leaders, including Confluence and CDHD, is one that is based on their recommendations to us. So with the full social distancing in place, the odds of transmission are relatively low, less than 1 in 200 most likely. And so if we had someone who does turn up positive, our first reaction will be clear the workspace that the employee was in, do as much cleaning as we can possibly do, full cleaning of the area. But then we would have folks who, the ones who need to be here in order to, they can't work remotely. So open to questions to me or to anyone else. Okay.
Steve, as I'm looking at the clock, I'm seeing that we're pretty close to noon. What would your wishes be?
You know, what I'd like to do is, Michelle Van Bogert is here to talk about the app, and I know there's been a lot of interest in the board in that, and I also would like to give her the opportunity to make the presentation. If you could hang in there with us for 5 to 10 minutes, I'd really appreciate it. Give her a chance to make that presentation.
Commissioners, is any objection? Hearing none, that would be fine.
Okay, we're going to invite Michelle up to the table to join. Talking about it would be lake level and river levels. We are fortunate that Michelle joined the organization just a few short months ago. This is a project that has really benefited from her participation. I know it's a large team that's worked on it, but it's been really great to have her here. And I want to turn it over to her.
Thank you. Hello, commissioners and members of the leadership team. As Steve mentioned, I'm Michelle Van Bogart. I'm IT program manager for the district's mobile technology strategy. I'm excited to join you today to share our first app, and which I hope will lighten the mood a little bit from the previous agenda item. I have no formal request for the commissioners today, other than just being one of our early adopters and sharing any feedback you have on the app. We are going to be a very user-driven app, so feedback is definitely welcomed and will be responded to. So the name of the app is Current. Current is a mobile app geared towards water recreation enthusiasts, such as myself, my family, as well as our residents and kind of local industries who depend on our region's water resources. This mobile companion provides near real-time water levels for Lake Chelan and the Columbia River between the Wells and Rock Island dams. This simple, informative app is available just like all other mobile apps. You can find it in the Apple App Store if you're an iPhone user, or in the Google Play Store if you're an Android phone user, and it's available just in time for boating season. So in case you're wondering about the name, I just wanted to quickly comment on that. Current is based on the value we provide our community, which is operating the electrical current and the river current in Chelan County. So that's where the name was born. And with that, I would like to show you the app. So
Commissioners, that would be slide two.
Yes, slide two. Moving on to slide two. If you are an iPhone user, the app is available for download right now from the Apple App Store. And if you have not had an opportunity to download it, you can follow the simple steps here on slide two. For those that are Android phone device users, we will have the app available in the Google Play Store in just a couple short weeks. So can I find out who has installed the app of the iPhone users in the room or virtually?
No, I have. This is Ann Condon. I have. It's fabulous. Okay. I love it.
Okay. Ann, anyone else?
Steve McKenna.
Yes, Bowles. I have. Bowles, yes.
Commissioner Smith has it.
Okay.
Unfortunately, Commissioner Arsenault has an Android.
No need to be unfortunate. Well, great. I'm glad that we've got a few of you. We'll follow along as I kind of step through the app. For those of you that don't have it yet, I'll do my best to give you kind of a clear idea of what you will experience when the app is available to you. All right. Let's go ahead and step through it. So when you come to the main screen, which is called the Explore screen, you'll be presented with a menu of features. First, before I go into those features, I do want to call out the Info tab at the bottom. This tab tells you more about the app and provides links to more information. Plus, on the Info screen there, we provide a feedback widget, which triggers an email to our team. Now, if you go back to the Explore tab by tapping the little magnifying glass icon at the bottom, I'll take you back to the Explore screen. From here, go ahead and tap the lake level icon. This takes you to a screen with the present day's elevation of Lake Chelan. You can also select a past or future date within the current river year. The future date is a forecasted elevation, it'll be denoted by a specific icon. If you tap any number on this screen, you'll get a pop-up that further explains what the number means. In the top right corner, you'll see a little eye with the circle. That's the info button, and that will take you to our Lake Chelan page off the chelanpud.org site. So now go ahead and tap the back button at the top left corner. This will take you again back to that Explore screen. This time, tap the river level icon. Users will first get the a data disclaimer, explaining that our data is estimated and I guess that's the best way to say it. The river levels are provided in a familiar Google map, so users can scroll the river up and down using their fingers or zoom in and out. The river level is shown for each river mile, again, between the Rock Island and Wells dams. It also provides river level elevations at various points of interest within that range also, such as boat launches, bridges, parks, things like that. The elevation data that you do see at the river miles and the points of interest are a rolling 30-minute average, and that data is refreshed every 5 minutes. So that's a little bit more insight about the number itself. So that covers the existing features we have in the app. But before I move on to tell you about the road ahead, I do want to explain a little bit about the visual design. While you don't see the Chelan PUD logo in the app, we did keep our brand in mind when we during this design process. We're using the website colors and voice. We definitely wanted that voice to be a recreational feel. And when you do search for the app in the app stores, it will be named Chelan PUD. So the Chelan PUD component will be expressed there. However, our design intentions are really to make the app discoverable and simple and intuitive to use. And the logo, at least in the current design, just didn't fit with those goals. However, with that said, again, like I said, we're a user-driven app. So we're definitely open to changing up the look based on user feedback or better ways we can express our value to the community. So just a little note there about the design. All right, I'm going to move on to slide 3, which talks a little bit about the road ahead. So tomorrow we'll formally release the iPhone version of the app by kicking off our communications plan. Through mid-May, our communications will be targeted at a group we are calling our early adopter community, which will include PUD employees, the commissioners, as well as some local recreation organizations such as Wenatchee Outdoors, TRED, the Row and Paddle Club. Our goal is to get some initial usage data as well as user feedback from some trusted sources. And then in May, our communications plan will go community-wide to through all of our standard channels as part of a broader river education campaign. As I mentioned, the Android version of the app will be ready in mid-April as a follow-up to tomorrow's iPhone release. And from there, we plan to release a new version of the app every 2 months with new features, enhancements, as well as some fixes we may discover along the way. This includes a release that focuses on functionality that makes our app friendly for impaired users. So that's something that is important to us and then is important to the district as well. So our plan is to continuously add value to the app so it's useful. It's a useful tool for lake and river safety as well as enjoyment. All right, moving on to slide 5. Last, I do want to recognize the team that made this possible.
Michelle, just for time's sake, I'm going to say this is the board has all of this, so okay. They've got the names in front of them.
Yep. So the again, truly across district effort. We really came together around a shared vision, set some goals, and just created that culture of accountability to make sure this app was available by boating season. So the names you see here represent our team and the different contributions they made to the project. Okay. So to kind of wrap this up, as I mentioned in the beginning, I have no formal request for you today, but be grateful for any feedback you'd like to send our way. There's a few ways you can do that. You can complete our early adopter survey. You can use the feedback widget in the app itself, or you can just send an email to our team that's listed here on slide 6. So that concludes the demo I have for today. I hope to return later this year and maybe show off some new features. We have actually quite a few ideas already brewing. So thank you for your time and attention, and I'll be happy to address any questions that you have.
Commissioners, any comments, feedback?
Michelle, this is Ann Congdon. I love the app. It's really great. I think you chose, you and everybody else who had a part in this chose the right one to do, you know, as the first step that you introduced, because I think you'll be surprised at how many people use it. And it's not just, you know, it's not just boaters and people who are recreationists, but anybody doing any work on the lake or on the river, they need to know the lake level today. And they also need to be able to look at that profile and see when it's, I get so many questions all the time, when's the lake going to start coming up? And so if they can just go with two touches of the screen to the lake level profile, that's hugely helpful. I look at the weather and at the lake level almost every day. I think you'll be surprised how many people do, maybe because I was a pilot and, you know, you have to pay a lot of attention to the weather. But I thank you and your crew for what you did. It's terrific.
Great. Thank you. All right. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Commissioners, I know we've gone well over what we normally do here, and I appreciate the extra time so we could get Michelle up and then let her out of here. We have a couple choices. We could start at 1, or if you would like the hour so you can get lunch and go to 1:15, we can make that work too. So at your choice.
Commissioners, do we have a preference?
I'll do either. I'm easy. Doesn't matter.
Either way. So if everyone's comfortable and we compress this to 45 minutes for lunch, we could start back up at 1. Being that we're all at home, it might be a little easier to make that work. Commissioners, in agreement with that?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
All right, so we will begin back at 1. I did want to make one offer at this moment in time. I said earlier that I would make public comment moments available if there are any members of the public that are on the phone. This would be an opportunity for any members that have a comment and would like to state that before we adjourn for lunch. Hearing no requests to make comments, we will recess for 45 minutes. We will re-adjourn at 1 o'clock to begin our business session. We are adjourned. Welcome to the March 30, 2020 business section of the Chelan County PUD Commission meeting. I'd like to thank everyone for calling in this morning, or this afternoon. In the spirit of social distancing due to the COVID-19 virus, today's meeting will be conducted by telephone. Members of the public that may be on the phone are encouraged to make comment and ask questions. If you wish to speak, please state your name and address for the record and limit your comments, please, to 3 minutes. I will open our phone lines for such comment later in today's session. Steve, did you want to move into resolutions?
Yeah, I think we let's go to the consent agenda first, and then we'll go to the regular agenda.
Okay. Commissioners, we have in front of us a consent agenda. Is there any motion to accept the consent agenda?
Commissioner Smith, I would move approval.
Commissioner Bull, second.
It's been moved and seconded. Is there any questions or comments on the consent agenda and on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The ayes have it.
Oh, good. Eric was just telling me I don't have to read the whole thing because I was about to say, I'm about to read you the longest resolution I've seen yes. in the entire time I've been here.
Heather, who's in the room, now holds the record for the longest resolution title.
Somebody needs some oxygen first.
So this is agenda item 10, and it has to do with refinancing or a variety of financing and refinancing of bonds that we are planning to move forward. Heather Ireland will be presenting.
Good afternoon, commissioners. This is Heather Ireland, lead treasury analyst for the district. I wanted to do something a little different than the regular resolution request process, and I wanted to provide some information on what has changed in the last couple of weeks since I previously presented in regards to this resolution. And really, a lot has changed, but there's also some things that are the same. But the things that have changed that I wanted to highlight first is that we do still recommend moving forward with adoption of the authorizing resolution to allow issuance of new money and refinancing bonds. But we want to also recognize that a couple of modifications to that plan are prudent at this time. The first one is to preserve liquidity and market timing flexibility. And to achieve that, we are recommending modifying our plan to delay some retirements until 2021, rather than taking that retirement action potentially this week. So that would be our first proposed modification to our plan. And the second modification is just a recognition that our timeline for actual issuance is tentative, and it's subject to further adjustment. We have a goal in mind of when we think that issuance would be attractive for the district, but we all need to remember that in current circumstances, that might need to shift around a little bit for the district to achieve the best results possible. So I wanted to highlight those two modifications first, and then do a brief market update to discuss what are some of those things that have been going on the last couple of weeks to month time frame. And on the first slide that I had provided with your board packet, just highlighting a couple of items. The financial markets have been volatile recently, and the primary driver of that is that financial markets in general don't like uncertainty. People get uncomfortable with uncertainty, and ultimately people are the ones making decisions behind financial transactions. Therefore, that has a ramification on financial markets. What happens often, and what certainly happened recently, is that investors are experiencing what we call a flight to quality. You might hear that term occasionally discussing markets. And really what that means is that investors are interested in purchasing what they view to be the most safe assets. And in their minds, that is U.S. Treasuries. Currently, they're purchasing U.S. Treasuries and little else, which means that the U.S. Treasury rates, because of that high demand, go down. Because there's not as much interest in other securities, that can actually increase the rates on other debt. Most of the time, municipal debt rates tend to trend in the same direction as U.S. Treasury yields. While they're certainly not as low as U.S. Treasury yields, they do tend to follow the same pricing curves. However, right now, that is a little bit dislocated. We're seeing some improvement even last week and this week, so that's good. That's definitely positive. But it does create some challenges around getting new municipal bond issuances sold in the market. Most issuers, if they have the choice, they are waiting until markets settle out. There are some new issuances planned for this week, and that's good because we see that as a positive sign that the markets are adapting to our new circumstances and settling. Just a perspective from historically, even in 2008, when we experienced the last financial crisis of some magnitude, unsettled markets did return to orderly functioning in weeks to months. So we have some historical precedents that even after periods of significant volatility and uncertainty, financial markets can return to functioning. And the biggest benefit for the district at this time point is that we are a very high quality credit. All of the work that's been done over the years by the district to make sure that our operations and financial condition are solid, this is where that comes to bear. We are often the type of credit that has the first to efficient market access because we are the type of credit that will be received well in the market. Lower rated entities have a more difficult time issuing in unsettled markets. So this is definitely a very, very large benefit of the district having that high credit quality is maintaining access to markets. Near term, the impacts to the district are that we, again, are moving forward with a responsive plan of finance and making adjustments as prudent. What we believe that means right now is that having flexible market access and preserving liquidity are our highest priorities. And therefore, we are recommending to proceed with the plan of finance to achieve savings and preserve liquidity when available, but delaying retirement of the $85 million of higher rate bonds until a later date. Rather than doing that retirement this week, we are proposing doing that retirement next year. So what does that mean for a time frame? A slightly adjusted timeline. This may be familiar from prior communications. The board did take action in December to adopt a reimbursement resolution to preserve flexibility for an issuance this year. And then 2 weeks ago, I provided a market update and we discussed our next steps. Today, we were planning on requesting the adoption of the bond issuance resolution, and we are doing that today. That would authorize but not require issuance of bonds. That provides the district with the flexibility to enter the financial markets and sell bonds when advantageous to us, but it does not require us to do so. This will, again, preserve liquidity and flexibility for the district to achieve savings where possible. Also, if the board does choose to adopt the bond issuance resolution, a reminder that we would be requesting your review of our offering documents and to provide comments or questions in regards to those by April 6th so that we could have those included in our offering documents when we intend to publish them, potentially as early as April 10th. After that initial offering document is published, if the markets are open and attractive to the district, we would plan to price and sell bonds approximately April 21st. We wanted to point out that there are some opportunities for local residents to participate in that bond issuance if they have an interest to do so. One of the challenges we're dealing with right now, again, is we're trying to preserve as much market flexibility as possible, so it makes it a little bit trickier than normal to ensure that we have good communication with our local residents who are interested in potentially purchasing bonds. What's most important for them to know is that they would need to work with a broker who is a selling group member. We are working on that local selling group listing this week, and we plan to be communicating with those local selling group members to ensure that they have the information they need to discuss with their clients how they can participate in the issuance. If a local resident, and we're defining a local resident as anyone in the four county area of Chelan, Douglas, Grant, or Okanagan counties, if they have an interest in purchasing bonds and they submit an order with a selling group member, their order would have priority and be filled first as long as bonds are available in that time period that they are wishing to purchase. We'll also be discussing with the communications department about including information in news releases so that we can provide direction to our website where a list of those local selling group members will be provided. In addition, if we have contacts from local brokers that are interested in being part of that selling group, we will work to get them added to that list. That list is being cultivated by our financial advisor currently, PFM, and we're basing the initial listing on our prior bond sales and the local selling group members we have worked with in those, as well as our financial advisor's recent regional experience with other local bond sales. After pricing and selling the bonds, tentatively scheduled for April 21st, the board would then need to sign on those closing documents. We're targeting that for April 27th. And then staff would complete the closing and actually deliver the bonds, and the district would receive proceeds around May 1st. I'd like to pause and discuss any questions that the commission has at this point.
Heather, this is Commissioner Smith. I just want to say thank you to you and Kelly for preempting the questions that I had last week. I know the two of you talked about it, and you covered all of the local availability very, very well in that presentation, so thank you.
Great. I'm glad we could answer your questions.
So, Heather, this is Dennis. Again, same question. So staff will be contacting local people who have displayed interest in purchasing bonds. Is that correct?
Yes. So there'll be two things we're doing. First is we'll be reaching out to local brokers to be on part of that selling group list so that they can discuss with their existing active clients if they have interest in participating in purchasing bonds. And second, for any local residents that we are aware of that have reached out to the commission or employees here at the district and expressed an interest in purchasing bonds, we will make sure we get in contact with them so that they can contact a local broker to place an order if that's what they're interested in doing.
Okay, and that'll be in an adequate time frame that if this is something new for them to do, they'll have time to work through it.
Yes, that's our plan, is to ensure ample time in advance of the pricing and sale of the bonds to make sure that they can have an account established with a broker that's part of that selling group, if that's what needs to happen in order for them to participate.
Okay. So you guys are going to do the reaching out?
Yeah, we're going to start reaching out this week, most likely. We wanted to make sure that we had a couple things in place first, one of them being... we want to make sure that the board has approved an issuance first. It would not make sense to start seeking out those individuals to let them know that we're doing a bond sale until we're certain that that's going to occur, or at least more certain that that's going to occur, right? So we're going to do that first, and then now that we have a little bit more firm timing on when we're targeting the bond issuance, it also makes more sense to move forward now. The last couple weeks have been a little bit challenging to dial in when the right timing is. I'm not sure if I can say more than that, but yeah, it's been a little bit tougher than normal.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Sure, thank you.
Heather, if customers, local customers in Wenatchee have investment accounts that are not with a local broker, will they still have that opportunity, or do they have to open an account with a local broker?
If they have an account with a broker who is not part of our selling group, we can, if they can contact us with who their broker is, we can work to get their broker added to the selling group so they wouldn't have to set up a separate account.
Okay, great. And so if I run across anyone who's interested, I'll just pass that on to you, or who's the contact person?
You can pass that on to myself, to Debbie Litchfield, or to Kelly Boyd. Any of us can make sure that that gets done.
Great, thank you.
Yes.
Commissioners, any further questions with respect to the resolution?
Commissioners, hearing none, I would suggest that we go on to agenda item 11, which is a related item, and Heather will be presenting that as well. This is a resolution authorizing the general manager to amend the service agreement SA number 13-162 with PricewaterhouseCoopers LLP to include quality control review services supporting the 2020 consolidated system bonds. Heather?
Thank you. This resolution is related to the bond issuance resolution in that it would not be required if not for the bond issuance resolution. The commission adopted an amended service agreement with PricewaterhouseCoopers PwC for audit services in 2019 to extend the contract for the audit services for financial statements in the calendar years of 2019, 2020, and 2021. This resolution is requesting a further extension of that service agreement to include not to exceed $60,000 of additional costs related to PwC's review of bond issuance related documents, specifically the offering, the official statement document that is required for issuance of the bonds. And I'll go ahead and pause now for questions on that resolution.
Commissioners, any questions?
I would just say that's it for our resolutions, and we are ready for a vote on resolutions, or excuse me, agenda items 10 and 11.
Commissioners, we have agenda resolutions 10 and 11 in front of us. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Bowles, I recommend agenda items 10 and 11 as described in our document today.
Is there a second?
I second. This is Steve McKenna.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. Do we have any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The ayes have it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Commissioners. And thank you, Heather. What we'd like to do now is come back to an item that we skipped over in the morning, which is the update on the public power benefit criteria. Just in the interest of time, we had moved that to the afternoon session. Commissioner Arsenault, is that okay?
Yes, that would be fine.
Okay. So what we're going to do is start, and Kelly Boyd is going to describe the financial criteria review, and then I will be picking it up from there.
Thank you, Steve. Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer. Why we're here for this conversation today is because there was an action item from the 2020 to 2024 strategic plan to look at modifying the financial criteria around the public power benefit program to ensure that the program could continue should the PUD reenter the capital borrowing market. So we're here today to discuss our recommendations for the updated criteria. And this is just our first chance to discuss this, so there's no action required today. Moving to slide 3 of the presentation, just doing a quick refresher on the current process for determining the public power benefit amount. We have a 3-step process. We look back to the prior year audited financial results to see what amount the results exceeded what was needed to meet our financial targets, and then we multiply that number by 10%. Then we look forward to the projected liquidity balances for the next 5 years, and we take the lowest year that we exceed the liquidity balances and multiply that amount by 10%. Then we choose the lower between the amounts in step one or step two to provide a calculated amount. And then that calculated amount just provides guidance to the board, and the board makes the final decision on what the amount should be for the next year. So that's how we've been operating our first 5 year period of having that program in place. We've learned a lot in the meantime, and some things have changed also. On slide four, highlighting a few of the things that have changed is that we have had a number of very successful years, and we have achieved our borrowing target, or our debt ratio, which was one of the key priorities from the last strategic plan. So now that we have achieved that target, we have a threshold that we are targeting to remain below. We also have additional items identified in the strategic plan of items that we would like to be able to provide through the public power benefit program. And then finally, we also raised electric rates to protect against low revenue scenarios and have a plan to set those revenues aside for future use. Moving to slide five, what has not changed in this period of time is the priority that we have, which is our highest priority, to invest in our core assets, and then also maintaining that debt ratio below our 35% threshold. So we want to ensure that public power benefit dollars do not threaten either one of those objectives. So we took all those items and balanced them together and developed new guidelines for your consideration. So turning to the next slide, slide six, big picture of our recommended criteria guidelines are to look backwards to the bottom line. Again, that makes sure that we kind of already earned the revenue and it's in the bank. And then to look forward to consider our forecasted capabilities to meet all of our district financial metrics, not just that sole focus on liquidity. And then based on those looks, establish a preliminary funding level that's included in the five-year forecast for planning purposes. So this would be trying to kind of establish the threshold for all 5 years for better planning than just 1 year at a time can provide. And then we would still recommend taking a look annually at the historical results and the look forward to ensure that what's in the plan is still consistent with the current circumstances at hand. That's kind of a big picture description. Next, I'm going to dive a little bit more into the details, and they start on slide seven. So to establish the preliminary amount that would be included in the five-year forecast, we would first look back to the prior audited financial results and look at the bottom line. We would look back for the five-year period, take the bottom line and divide it by five, which would give us the five-year average bottom line, and then multiply that number by 10%. So looking at historical results, that would be about $10 million a year would be the annual average of 10% of that. So that recognizes the strong financial results that we have achieved over the last 5 years. Then we would look forward. So moving to slide eight, we would look forward to the projected results for the next 5 years. And we would look at all of our financial metrics. And our first one we would look at is our debt cover. And that's the first hurdle for looking at this. So if we look at the debt ratio and it is either flat or improving, then that kind of gets through the first hurdle to do the rest of the calculation. However, if we started to see an upward trend in our debt coverage and we were starting to get near our targeted amount, that would be cause for concern and evaluating more of the status. But assuming we, as we are currently forecasting, that our debt ratio continues to improve, then we would go to the next step, which is the second hurdle, and we would look forward to our debt coverage requirement in an unusual case. So this would be looking at if we had a low revenue scenario, and our target for debt coverage in that is a 1.25 cover, and that preserves the ability for us to issue additional bonds during that period, should that be a necessity. So we would take the amount that we exceed that requirement in each of the next 5 years and multiply that number by 10%. Then we would compare that calculated amount to the amount that we would need in an expected case to meet our regular target, which is a 2.0 debt cover target. And we have that target because that is what our peer AA rated entities, that is the range for that. And that is our one of our strategic goals, to maintain the AA rated as a AA rated entity. So we would look at the amount that was calculated and make sure that that amount wasn't bigger than 50% of an amount that's in excess of what we would need to make a 2.0 cover. And, you know, that's because these are forecasts. The numbers can change a lot in a forecast as the conditions change. And so we want to be conservative and make sure that any calculated amounts don't put us at risk of not meeting any of the future financial metrics. So by doing the look back and the look forward, this provides a range of results. So moving on to slide 9, this range of results can also be set for each year in the 5-year period based on the analysis. And then same thing, we would recommend that we refresh that analysis annually each year after we have our financial or audited financial statements, just to confirm that we're still on the right path or if we need to recalculate because future forecasts have changed. So that's kind of the words around the more detailed calculation. If we turn to slide 10, all of the numbers are included there of what this looks like when we calculate based on these proposed guidelines. And the calculated range results in a $3.4 million to $10.4 million range based on these criteria.
And I'm going to pick it up from there just to say, so what we're really doing here, I think, is a couple things. One, we're trying to consider what amount of money is available to spend that creates a low risk of, if we spend it, that there would be a need for an additional rate increase of some kind. So recall, we have rate increases that are adopted at this point for June 1st. Water, wastewater, and fiber, because we're trying to get those businesses to be self-sustaining. Electric, because we're trying to put money away to protect against an extreme situation, low revenue situation. So what we've done here is looked at the thing that would drive a rate increase, particularly the debt service coverage ratio is the key element of that in this next rate period, and said, so how are we protected against that? And then also looking backwards and saying, well, how have we done the last few years and how strong are we financially? You put all that together and you get this range of backward looking being a little over $10 million and forward looking being somewhere between $3.5 million to a little over $6 million. We put all that together, and in order to make a recommendation to the board, I'm going to jump out and just do that and say, something that seems like a comfortable level is something in about the $6 million per year range. Recall that what we would be doing is including that as in our financial forecast for the next 5 years. Each year we would revisit in the spring to see how we're actually doing to set the following year number. So what would be headed towards here is what number goes into the financial forecast, and then what number would we tentatively be putting in for 2021, knowing that the board doesn't actually adopt the budget until December of this year. So that's our thinking about that. We can jump over to slide 12. Our summary of this is that we're looking to protect against negative financial scenarios by funding from revenues already earned and available after the financial metrics are met, to enable funding when forecasts include routine borrowing in the five-year planning cycle because the previous criteria did not allow that. And we're in a different place now with respect to hitting our debt ratio. Ensuring preservation of ability to borrow and meet debt service requirements over the long term in alignment with district financial metrics, and establishing a preliminary funding level that's included in the five-year forecast, and calculating an annual adjustment that can go up or down. With that, I will pause to see if there are any questions from the board. Oh, and I should say one other thing. We did also certainly look at the issues of what things came out of the strategic plan that were based on the availability of public power benefit funds, and took that into account as well. And with that, I'm open to questions.
Commissioners, any questions, comments, thoughts?
Steve McKenna. Steve, would you repeat that last statement you said?
So we looked at the commitments that we made as part of the strategic plan, because there are things that go above and beyond what we've done in the past. Kelly's reminding me that's on slide 4. The Dryden Wastewater Project, we've got some commitments with respect to the Discovery Center. We still have a commitment to develop an accelerated plan for fiber, which we had planned to bring you in the first quarter. That's not going to happen with all the things going on with COVID-19 right now, but we are still working on that. We're actually getting fairly close and coming up with something there. So those things are costs that were not addressed in the last strategic plan. They are in the new one. And so we were thinking about that as well in terms of what do we need in order to be able to carry out the plan. Does that answer your question, Commissioner McKenna?
Yes, thank you very much. Any other comments? I'd like to maybe just ask a question, Steve. Earlier in the week, you had mailed out a liquidity challenge email. Is this the appropriate time to maybe talk about that and how it might relate into the public power benefit?
That would be the perfect segue for it, and it would be the next set of slides.
Would you rather I hold off on bringing this up yet?
Just to see if there are any other questions from other commissioners on the material that we presented so far before we jump into this. I do think that they're related, though.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. If we take the $6 million and then do we subtract our previous commitments from that, and then the leftover is what we would have to do work with for this particular year. Is that correct?
So one piece around that is our ongoing commitment to fiber expansion is really the annual amount that we would take out of this proposed amount. The rest of the decisions that have been funded were fully funded in the year that they were chosen to be part of the project. So there aren't carry forward amounts for anything other than fiber expansion.
And the fiber is about $2 million, is that correct?
It ranges from 1.5 to 2.5. So $2 million to have as kind of that general rule of thumb, I think, is a pretty good one.
Yeah. Okay. That helps my thinking. Thank you.
And I'd probably just add to that that while it is an annual decision for the board, we probably feel fairly committed to the Parks Waiver Pass program. It would have to be a decision of the board to stop that. Otherwise, it would continue to come out of this fund.
Okay. Thank you.
Kelly, this is Ann. I just wanted to say thanks for a very understandable, clear methodology or formula for this, and thanks for keeping us on the straight and narrow with this to help us
help guide us.
Thanks for that, Ann. As with everything we do here, it's a team effort. I just get to be the one to try to explain it. So thank you.
Sure, understood, sure.
Okay, not hearing more at the moment. I'll go to the liquidity challenge again. I think these do fit together, so if other questions arise, they'll fit well to go back and forth between these two presentations. So I think we've got a new issue. I think we all know that we have a new issue that's come up in the last 30 days with respect to COVID-19 and its impact in particular on the local economy. We've got individuals and businesses that are facing near-term, and we're not sure how long near-term is, but it's certainly going to be at least months of cash flow challenges. And that creates a, could be, a widespread impact on the economy of Chelan County that affects not just those people who are directly being impacted today, but then spending throughout the economy. It is possible to think about actions that we could take to respond to that, and as a community service organization, it seems that certainly we would want to at least consider what actions we could take to support customer owners during this difficult time, and to consider in the context of the Public Power Benefit Program, because Public Power Benefit was designed to be to support the things that are within our statutory nexus. We have the authority to do them, but don't necessarily have a strong business case to proceed. And the types of things that we would consider here would likely fall into that category. So this next conversation, we'd be seeking board guidance whether to consider some, all, none of the following options. The first one, which we don't think actually wouldn't be intended to count against public power benefit spending, would be to delay the adopted rate increase for the residential electric, water, wastewater, and fiber that are scheduled for June 1 until December 1, a six-month delay that matches the start date for the commercial and industrial electrical rate increases. The as I mentioned earlier, the electric rate increase was designed to produce revenue that would go into rate stabilization. So it was really a let's gather some funds when things are good to try to make sure that we'll be in a good position if things go bad, that this may not be the best time for that. And the water, wastewater, and fiber increases were designed to move those businesses to be more self-sufficient. Again, the question is this the right time to start a rate increase like that? This would be actually contrary to the customer survey feedback, but the customer survey feedback came well before COVID-19 and the effects of that. So that would be the first option. The second option would be to continue the no shutoff and no late fee penalties, which, of course, we've already adopted, that John Stoll mentioned this morning, and that we are putting in place through the end of April and could well go longer than that. The benefit of these is that the policies of no shutoff and no late fees targets those who are in most financial difficulty. You know that because they're having difficulty paying their bills. There is a cost to this. It means that we have reduced cash. Reduced cash means less interest earnings. And it also it means that because bills are getting bigger, you have an increased risk of default that can occur. So you get someone who has a very large bill and can't pay it, and then they struggle with that as you've gotten months down the road. Of course, this policy is already in place until further notice and can be extended as the board sees fit. Third option was comes back to the conversation that we had this morning. We're learning more about our low-income community that we serve. And there's an option here to take advantage of that learning that we've now got in front of us to revise and expand the low-income weatherizations and assistance programs that we offer. So that would allow us to focus on homes with high energy costs relative to income, so again, focused on particular groups. And the funding could come through weatherization, and weatherization, of course, is a terrific program because it's like to think of it as the teach a person to fish program rather than give a person a fish, because you're actually helping them for years into the future. And Then we also have our existing Helping Hands program that can be used to support those who need short-term assistance. Final option, and this one there's probably some reservations about, I would say, here. This is considering actions targeted to specific customers in need. This would ask customers to self-identify that they have serious needs due to the coronavirus crisis, and then develop and evaluate some targeted actions to support these customers consistent with our statutory authority. And I want to underscore that consistent with our statutory authority. Certainly there would be, we've been down this path before of looking at can we do special rates, and we constantly struggle with the issue as to whether it's discriminatory treatment or not. And we would have challenges here if we were trying to go down this path. But we're not saying we can't do it. We just know that there'd be a lot of difficulties and we'd have to give a lot of thought to how it could be done. And then depending on the actions, this also could be administratively burdensome because you're taking select customers, they're self-identified, developing special programs for them. It just can be difficult and time-consuming in order to put something like that in place. So those are the options we thought of. We think of potentially, particularly options 3 and 4, as being more in the realm of public power benefit, an extended cutoffs and no cutoffs and no penalty could also potentially be thought of as a public power benefit program. So that's why we put it out there today as an option for you to consider as we're thinking about where we're going with the size of the PPP program. This is probably good to be thinking about, is this an area that we should be exploring and thinking about as well, and hooking these two ideas up together. With that, I'm done and open to questions and comments.
Commissioners, thoughts, please?
Let me ask a question on Helping Hands. That comes through people volunteering out of their monthly payments, a given amount. It goes into a fund that's administered by Community Action. Is that the pathway?
That is the existing pathway, yes. And we don't think of that as a public power benefit program because we're not allocating dollars that are from all ratepayers. And select group of ratepayers have self-selected into the program and offering what they want to offer.
But, so the question behind the question is, can the PUD make a contribution to Helping Hands?
Commissioner, this is Eric. I'll have to take a look at that. It's not a new novel issue to me.
Yeah, you know, the thought is they already have a mechanism set up for identifying and handling the administration of those funds, and it might be a way to, if we could, contribute to Helping Hands and then let Community Action go ahead and continue to administer it in the appropriate way in which they've been doing. So that's just a thought. I don't know if we can do it or not.
I am already working on it.
So in addition to the legal side of it, I think one of the things that we learned from this morning's presentation, and it was news to me in the last couple months, is that it's not clear that the way that program is being administered, that there's a fair distribution of the benefits across the county. So
yeah.
We'll need to give some more thought. As was mentioned this morning, we probably are going to be looking at some proposals to revise those programs to expand the availability.
So this is Steve. My personal thoughts are on the first option, to delay the rate increase, I think is appropriate. The way that been described there, along with the second option of no shutoff for a period of time, and I don't know what needs to be put in place in the length. Seems like we could set a date and or a length, and it would change as it seems to be changing on a daily basis. But I think that would be appropriate, and I'd
like to hear what others think on option 3 and 4 before I said anything more there. I think adding what we talked about, what Josh talked about today, is appropriate. You know, that we can put out, I think it's a way to put out there in public that we're going to be visiting with folks, you know, on weatherization, and I can't remember the term that he eloquently put in there. That's another thing that we can do. So I feel comfortable with all three of those things. Commissioners, your thoughts?
This is Randy. I'm glad that I waited for the two former school administrators to eloquently cover the topics. I'll be a little bit more brief as the farmer. I like option 1. I think option 2, we need to do that. As a matter of fact, right now we're under a state mandate, I think, to maintain some of that. And option 3 is, you know, is following this morning's presentation, if we can somehow really target those that need the help the most, that would be absolutely great. So those first 3, I think, need to be more actively explored. Item 4, I think Dennis had a good idea there. So maybe we can look at a targeted option. So we need to do our part to help our community in a time of need when we can do it under our legal constraints.
Ann, would you like to make a comment?
Yes. I will be brief, too. I definitely support 1 and 2. I couldn't agree more that we need to step up and do our part to help the community in this time of need. I had thought I really don't want to be in a position, or we don't want to be in a position of picking losers and winners, and you know, and have the administrative burden of determining who gets help and who doesn't. So I too like Dennis's idea of taking, you know, not reinventing the wheel, taking advantage of the you know, the format, the program that's already set up. And so if we could lean into that, I think that would be great. So at this point, those are my thoughts. Thanks.
So Ann, you'd be in favor of 1 and 2 and a targeted approach?
Well, I would be in favor of a targeted approach if we can use the machinery that's already been set up. I don't support having the PUD have to, you know, having our staff go in and determine who, you know, set up that whole structure of who qualifies and who doesn't and does not. So more, you know, we'll need more information, I guess, on that, or I'll need to consider what the options are further.
Well, this is Gary, and I guess I will also attempt to be brief that I would support options 1 and 2. I'm looking at this a little bit, maybe just a little bit differently with respect to both residential but also small businesses that are struggling. And, you know, I think the services that we pretty much provide right now and that the organizations that we work through focus more on the residential than on the small business. And having owned a small business, I know that, you know, things like this can actually destroy your company. So I don't know what the answer would be, but in terms of mechanisms that maybe the PUD has at their disposal to look at providing targeted assistance to residential and small business, I would be in favor of that.
Well, let me just say that that is really directive of guidance. Gives us something I think we can work with. Let me just check and see if anyone wanted to offer anything else in terms of comments, having heard the other commissioners.
Yeah, Steve, just a comment. I think the data that we received today related to, as an example, the light yellow colored zone and people who are have a higher energy burden than others in Chelan County. I think there's a basis there for some really good long-term thinking and adjustment and, providing assistance. I think the situation we're in now, people need help tomorrow. They need help today. So what is it that we could expedite to give some kind of relief? And I apologize. I also, have thought about but didn't state, I agree with Gary in terms of long businesses, small businesses. If it doesn't do a whole lot of good for this thing to get over, and then people not have a business to return to go to work, and so it's kind of a chicken and egg argument, but it may be a benefit to assist small businesses and help tide them over until they can get back on their feet and operating and going. I just can't imagine what it would be like to be in that spot right now, but I'm in favor of 1-2 for sure, and then some kind of thought related to residential customers and small businesses. So those are just my thoughts, and I've had plenty of opportunity.
So this is Randy, and as a follow-up to what Dennis and Gary just said, Gary, thank you for jogging my memory on a conversation I had last week with Steve as it relates to small businesses, because I fully support if there's anything we can do without overburdening ourselves through administratively, targeting small businesses that are in need, because they're going to be, by the end of this, at a true crisis point. They're hurting now, but they'll be at a crisis point in a couple of months.
Not hearing any more comments, let me make a suggestion about how to proceed here. I think we've got some great guidance to work with. I think there's certainly agreement on options 1 and 2. Option 1, I would guess, I'll look to our general counsel, would require a resolution because we have a resolution in place.
Yeah, we'll need board action for the delay of the rate implementation, but we can prepare that and bring it back at the next meeting.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, is that would create the opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So we can do it in a thoughtful way, and so we can address the for how long and what happens after the first 6 months and some of those kinds of things. So I think we can put that together. So we'll just plan on that will be there for option 1. For option 2, by the next time we get together, we'll be halfway through April, and what we have in place is no cutoffs, no late fees through the end of April. We will bring a recommendation as to whether to extend that for another month. Again, that's something that you have delegated to the general manager, so it doesn't require a resolution, but it's worthwhile for us to talk about before we take another step there. With respect to the thoughts about the residential programs in general, first of all, I'd say I think there is an opportunity to use some of that existing information, but I also heard we don't want to chew this for 6 months to come up with a plan. So let's see what we can do to come up with something quickly. And Eric will look into the question as to the PUD making a contribution to the Helping Hands program. In addition, we'll be thinking about how can we extend the scope of the distribution of those dollars. What can we do in an expedited fashion to address that? The one that I heard very clearly that's not quite as clear to me yet about how we will address it is working with small businesses. I definitely hear the need. So that's a good challenge for us, is to figure out what we can do. So we will work on that between now and the next board meeting. Is that a good summary of where we're at? Did I miss anything?
Sounds very good.
I think that's a good summary. Yeah, good summary, Steve.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. So I would like to just get, we don't need a formal vote on this. I would like to get, I don't know how you do a head nod over the phone. So let me just say, without objection, we would plan to move forward with the $6 million per year PPB for the financial forecast and be planning for $6 million for 2021. Is there any objection to that?
No objection.
No objection.
Great. Okay, we're gonna we'll move forward with that. Okay, with that, we actually have come to the end of the that portion of the agenda. And I'm catching up on pages here. We have no manager items today, so we are ready to move to commission items.
Commissioners, do we have any items that we would like to discuss?
Just congratulations and condolences to Randy for having his term extended at Laputa.
I was going to say something too, Dennis, but you're braver than me.
Well, Steve asked me if this would actually make me the longest serving president, and I said no, it'll make me second, soon to be third. And Jeff Hall holds that record right now. And if I manage to pass the gavel in the next few months, I think Liz will have a longer term than me, so I'll end up being third. So there's no awards for third place.
So this is Steve. Let's see, am I in? Yeah, okay, I'm unmuted. So I just wanted to cover, make sure I understand on our timesheets, we can do that electronically. Just send that note into Liz or Lisa, and then our email becomes that part of the record of that. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And the other question that I had, I don't know if anybody can help. Has anybody heard anything about the June APPA? Or, you know, as I'm looking at having to get travel done, and do we just kind of wait and see how things look? Or does anybody know something I don't?
Yeah, there was a note from Joy Ditto to the board at the end of last week about this, and they are really trying to hold on as long as they can to try to make this work. The National Conference is a moneymaker for APPA, and they're hesitant to give it up. So it's going to be at least a few more weeks, and the impression I got is that they may try to go as late as late April or early May before making a final call on that.
So I think, commissioners, are you guys just holding off on plane ticket purchases, or?
Steve, I already have my tickets purchased, but as a Alaska Gold member, I can cancel without a penalty. And I'm not sure. I mean, currently, right now, Alaska is offering free cancellations during the virus period, but it is hard to say what will happen by June.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I guess This is Randy, and I guess I have my tickets purchased also, and I'm golden, so I will get them refunded. But I'm really actually leaning more heavily on another piece of information in my final decision-making, because even if they decide to relax the restrictions and allow for large meetings, I cannot, without some type of like the chloroquine and erythromycin solution, putting that many people together under relaxed restrictions, I think is a terrible idea, without some type of protection available. So I'm leaning toward ending up not going.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of where I'm at, Randy. I know we've got some reasons to go, but our recognition and awards aside, I'm just feeling fairly uncomfortable. All right. That was all. That was everything on my list.
Okay, I think perhaps we can move on to the follow-up on delegation of action items.
We had three items from the last meeting. One of them was Kelly following up with Commissioner Arsenault on zero coupon bonds. That was done the day of the meeting. We have two other items that Justin is responsible for, both of which are not timely. They'll take some time to get back, so we've just scheduled for later in the year to get back with you on those.
And delegation of action items for today?
We had a few. So we were going to see if we could pull out of the data that Hassan and his firm had come up with the mobile homes that are owner-occupied versus renter-occupied. We will also work to come up with an outreach plan for how we will address the potential low-income program changes. We are going to look into the suspended disconnects and try to get some sense of the geographical trends that's going on inside of that within the county. And then Eric will determine if the PUD can make a contribution to Helping Hands. Did we miss anything?
I think you've got it.
That's it for us.
Okay. So at this point, we're looking at matters of general business that may become necessary in front of the commission. Any comments? This is also a moment when I'd like to invite any of the public that might be on the phone. So members of the public are encouraged to make comment and ask questions. I'm going to open the phone lines up now. If you wish to speak, please state your name, your address for the record, and if you would be kind enough, please limit comments to 3 minutes. Hearing no comments, I think we are in need of an executive session. Is that correct? How much time will we need?
I think you would want 1 hour.
Okay. Do we need a break? Anybody need a break? Or can we roll right into executive session?
I'm fine to move forward.
Okay, let's do it. Let's go into executive session to discuss with legal counsel, agency enforcement action, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCW, and to review the performance of a public employee as also authorized by RCW. We will be in executive session for 1 hour.
Gary, do we need to hang up and call into the other number?
Yes, thank you. We are coming out of executive session. It is March 30, 2020. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we shall stand adjourned.